it is said, that if it rained a whole eon, you know how long eon is? It's a very long period of time, a kalpa. If it rained for the duration of a whole eon, he could tell you how many of the drops of water that fell from the skies would fall into the great oceans. So he can tell you the exact number. And not just that, he could also tell you how many of those drops that fell from the skies fall onto the great mountains. And not just that, he could also tell you how many of those drops of water that fell from the sky would fall onto land. So land meaning not the oceans, not the mountains, just flat land. So this is not just a rain of 1 or 2 days, but torrential rains that rains throughout a whole eon. Who do you think I speak of? The perfect one? No. Absolutely. I'm talking about one of his masterpieces. I'm talking about one of the Buddha's children. I speak of the great Sariputta Thera. That is the magnitude of his wisdom, it is said. On many occasions, the Buddha makes reference to the great Sariputta Thera's wisdom. As you know, he was the chief among the wise monks in the Buddhist order. His wisdom was only second to that of the Buddha. And we are so fortunate that we had individuals like himself in the Buddha's asana, because if not for him, I don't think that today we'd be able to discuss the Dhamma as we do. Understand, learn, practice the Dhamma as we do. Because on many occasions, it was he who went through the trouble of explaining, describing, detailing many of the suttas that the Buddha would preach. Just in terms of what is referred to as the Matruka Pali. In other words, he would just give a very brief exposition of his understanding, and the great Sariputta Thera was always there by his side to take on the task of detailing it, analyzing it, and expounding it so that people like you and I could make sense of it. So if Sariputta Thera was so great, can you imagine what his teacher must have been like? It is said that there is no one, if not for the Buddha, who could pose questions to the Sariputta Thera to which he may not find an answer to. Now on one occasion when the Buddha descended from the great heavens after having spent the 7th Vas retreat. He went up to the heavens to preach the Dhamma to his mother. And then once he descended to the city called Sankassa, a great congregation of the Mahasangha as well as many other devotees, just like yourselves, gathered to receive him. So the Buddha made use of this occasion to show off his eldest son. Who was the eldest son again? The Sariputta Thera. He made use of this occasion to show off his skills. So the Buddha starts to ask a few questions of the audience. Initially he starts asking questions which even the Prutakjanas are able to answer. So people start answering those questions. Now you can imagine this is a huge gathering of people. Far more than anyone could count. For miles and miles, many people are gathered. Then he starts asking questions that only a Sotapanna could answer. So what do the Pruthakjanas do at that time? They keep shut. Because they can't even make sense of the question, let alone give an answer. And then after he'd done that, then he goes on to ask questions that only a Sakrudagami person can answer. So the Sotapannas now, they understand the question, just about, but there's no point in them trying to come up with an answer, because the answer is not obvious to them yet. Because that is yet to happen for them, as only once practice, once you mature in your practice, is when these answers begin to appear. So he continues like this, and then he asks questions that only an Anagami person can answer, and the Sakrudagamis, the Sotapannas and the Pruthakjanas, they all remain silent. So then he goes on to ask questions that only Rahatan Mahanses can answer. And then the rest of them, they are quiet. And then finally he asks a few more questions. And all the Rahatan Mahanses are also silent, except for one. Sariputta Thera answers those questions. No one else in the audience is qualified to give the answers to those questions. They don't have the answers. They can understand the question, more or less, but they don't have the answers. And then after that Q&A was done, then the Buddha asks a few more questions. And now even the Sariputta Thera is silent. So the Sariputta Thera is looking around. Who is it in this audience that can answer this question? He looks up at the skies. There are the Devas and the Brahmas. They don't have answers. He looks around at his fellow monks. None of them have answers. So what does he do in the end? He brings his palms together and says, "Oh, Venerable Sir, there's not a mortal in this whole world who can answer these questions. If I have failed to answer those questions, there is none who can even make an effort to try and answer such questions. Because these are questions that were so profound, and only a Supreme Buddha can answer such questions." So what does the Buddha do? Out of compassion, he answers those questions very briefly. And the moment he does that, Sariputta Thera now has the answers. And then what does he do? He understands this, and then he goes on to deliver those Dhamma points to the other people who were gathered there, helping them attain various fruits of the noble stages. Wonderful and amazing things have happened in the Buddha's asana, but they're all rooted in one place. These are the miracles. You know, just this morning I was thinking to myself, how all of you have committed your lives to the Buddha's asana. Today it has become that you no longer believe what your teachers say. I mean your school teachers. I don't think any of your school teachers would have imagined you being here today with a prayer mat on your shoulder. That is not the future that they wanted for you. They imagined a very different future for you, didn't they? They wanted you to become scientists and lawyers and teachers and mathematicians and professors, doctors and so on. So you went somewhere along that path. Now, those who have lived a fair part of your life, you would have achieved some of those. But then there are young people in the audience as well. This is not what your teachers would have wanted. So there was a time in your life where you started following what your teacher said. These are the teachers you met at school. But then after that, you came across the Buddha's teaching. And now you no longer believe what they say. Now you believe what the Buddha says. So much so that you have actually changed the course of your life entirely. You were heading this way. This is where we all started. You were heading this way. There were teachers there. They were this way. Scientists. Doctors. So you kept going, and then you heard the Dhamma. What happened then? It was at this junction you had to choose a path. Then you almost went like this, and then went somewhere else. This happened for each and every one of you. Now you are heading somewhere else. This is all worldly. Then that is out of this world. This has happened for each and every one of you. To whatever degree, to whatever extent you are able to do it, this has happened for each and every one of you. Because your teachers, they all they knew was about these things. So that is what they taught you. But now you have lost trust in them. They would lose trust in themselves if they heard the Dhamma. But you've lost trust in them because you realize that these paths, they don't take you to ultimate happiness. So now you're on a different path. And that path takes you to becoming someone who is worthy of worship. Not just from your children, not just from your students, but from all sentient beings in 31 realms of existence. The sasana is an amazing thing. It's an incredible thing. It has changed people's lives. Right from the great elders like the Sariputta Thera, the Mahakashyapa and the Moggallana Thera of 2,500 years ago, to the young Sariputtas of today, to the young Kashyapas of today, those who grow up having such individuals as their idols. Ask your child who his hero is today. Ask your daughter, ask your son who his hero is today. He used to name these people. Someone who was a doctor, someone who was an engineer, someone who was a scientist, maybe a rocket scientist. They would have had as their heroes. But today, if you ask your children who their heroes are, they're not people who will exist in this world. They're people who are out of this world. Those are their heroes. In fact, if I ask each and every one of you who is your hero, the answers that you that will come up to you would not be anyone here. You've now transcended the heroes in this world. In fact, there is no one in this world. If you leave the Arahatan Mahanses to a side, and because we have to consider that they are not really part of this world, although they live in this world, they are not part of this world, are they? There is no one in this world today who qualifies to be considered your hero. Don't you agree? Do you think if we asked people who live in this world to step forward, anyone in this world, right? People who are great scientists, great thinkers, very educated people, professors and so on, right? If we asked maybe even, Nobel Prize winners, right? Even if we asked one of them to step forward, if they believe that they are qualified to be your teacher or your role model, there's no one who can step forward today. Because to you, none of them are role models. Your role models are not worldly individuals. That is how your lives have transformed. This is the journey that we are on, ladies and gentlemen. This is the journey that we want to complete. This is the journey that we want to see to its end. And we have our fathers, we have our forefathers, we have those great men and women who have walked this path before us to guide us and to be our role models. That's why I mentioned one or two names there. The great elder Sariputta Thera. What a fantastic role model. Unblemished characters. No weaknesses to spot, no flaws to spot. Where can you find people here who are unblemished? No flaws, no weaknesses. You know, here we'll have people who are maybe very good as a teacher, excellent in their, you know, in their professional careers. You've gone to the pinnacle of it. But is there anyone in the audience who can say that you are flawless? Would you really put yourself forward and say, be 100% like me to anyone? Could you say that? Not even I could say that. I couldn't say be 100% like me. You might say be 50% like me. The other 50, don't be like that. If you spoke to your children, you'll say, you know, take the best parts of me, but leave the other part. Don't take that from me. In some ways, I'm an example. In other ways, I'm an example of what not to be like. You might even say that to your children. But here we are talking about individuals like Sariputta Thera, Mahamoggallana Thera, Mahakashyapa Thera. There was nothing about them that we could say, you know, that part of his life, don't take that as an example. There's no part of their lives you can say anything like that about. Flawless characters, perfect characters. And because now we have them as our role models, that is where we are heading. So that ultimately we can also become like that. Flawless characters. And that's what we're here for. So, bearing in mind that these are the individuals who have defined our destination on this journey. These are the role models today that we hold as an example and we strive to become like. Let us bring our palms together then, in veneration of their holy name, as well as that of our great father, the Supreme Buddha, who was the source of inspiration for all of them, who was the fount of wisdom for all of them, our teacher, our guide. And as we do so, let us also remind ourselves that we renew our pledge of allegiance and an oath that we take upon ourselves to walk the noble path and become individuals just like them, so that we can be, so that they can be proud of us one day.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
If you're asked to be a mentor to a young person today, now I want you to come up with an honest answer, right? You have to be genuine to yourself. You have to be honest to yourself. If you're asked to mentor a young individual today, be that a young boy or a young girl who is looking to build up their future, and they're planning their future and they're trying to imagine what their future is going to be like. Ke sara sara. So they've come and asked you, what should I be? What would you ask them to be? What would you advise them to be? What would you recommend they become? Engineers? Why not? What's so wrong with engineers? Engineers in the house? I used to be one. There are a few. Teachers? There are a few. Yes. People in the medical field? Nurses, doctors, so on. And lawyers? In the legal profession? So, why not? If someone came up to you and asked you, a young man, say 14, 15, right, they're really setting themselves, they want to set themselves up for a good future. They come and ask you, what should I be when I grow up? What are you going to tell them? Because they're going to come and ask you, they know that you're an engineer. You're a chartered engineer, not just about any engineer, you're a chartered engineer. And they come and ask you, when I grow up, what should I be? What are you going to tell them? Not engineer? No? Teachers? Why not? What's so wrong with being an engineer? You know, when they ask you, who should I be when I grow up? If you have your wits about you, you need to understand that that is not the exact question they're asking. they are yet to find the words to express the real question, because that's not the real question they're asking. Because they think now, as young children, they have to have some profession, some career that they need to get into. They have to have an ambition, right? Didn't we all used to be there? There was a time in our lives, weren't there, where we would question ourselves, you know, where would we go? Where do we want to go? What do we want to do in the future? Because people used to come and ask you that. Your adults, your aunties, your uncles, grandparents, mothers, friends, and so on, they'd come and ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? Now, today, if they ask you this question, you're telling me that you're not going to give any of these answers. But these were the answers most likely that your parents would have given you. These were the answers your teachers would have given you. But why don't you give those answers today? I'm trying to get you to focus on a point that I want to try and make. Why don't you give them these answers today? They're coming and asking, what should my ambition be? And you're telling me that you wouldn't give them any of these answers, answers which are commonly issued and offered as prospective ambitions to individuals. Young people, you know, if you find youth mentors, right, or youth counseling, these sort of programs where you can go and get advice and inspiration to go on to become someone in someday. And, you know, even if you go and get some consultation on what sort of programs, what sort of study you have to take. These are some of the professions. They are very well respected, very well regarded, very highly regarded. And society gives a lot of place and status to some of these professions I have put on the board. These are just a few. There are plenty more. But if asked you today, which one of these would you recommend to them? You're telling me none of them. Why is that? What's so wrong about becoming an engineer? Someone comes and asks you, when I grow up, I want to become someone, who should I be? You're telling me today you don't give the answer, Putha, go on and become an engineer and I'll help you with that. I'll recommend the books, I'll recommend the courses, right? I'll give you instruction, I'll even mentor you. Because I'm an engineer, so I'll help you become one. You're telling me you won't say that today. Why not? What's so wrong with becoming an engineer? What is the question they've asked you? When I grow up, who should I be? Right? What should my ambition be? But you're telling me your answer is, you're certainly not going to say an engineer. Why is that? Because now you read between the lines. Although you hear the literal words, what should I be when I grow up? Now you know that the real question is not that. Is it? That's not the real question. Those days you used to answer that very question. People would ask that question of you and you would answer that question, the question that was being asked, like what's your name? You know, there are no two ways of interpreting that. You just give your name. So when people used to ask you, what should I be when I grow up, used to give one of these answers. Usually the profession or the career that you'd give that as an answer. But today you're telling me that that is not the answer you'd give, because you read between the lines. And when you start reading between the lines, you identify that there's a very different question that is being asked here. But the kid doesn't know that that is the question they ought to be asking. Do you agree with me on that? So how do you interpret that question? Ambition. What is my ambition? What should be my ambition? How do you interpret that question today? What do I have to do to be happy? That is what they're asking, really. That question is dressed up in words such as ambition, career, profession, and all these other words. Future goals, right? These are aspirations, these are words that dress up. If you remove all that, you know, the naked truth is simply, what do I have to do to be happy? That's why you don't offer any of these answers. But why not? Can't you be happy by becoming an engineer? I mean, I keep focusing on engineer because I was one, so I know what becoming an engineer is like. I was a computer engineer, so I know what that's like and what you have to do to become one. and what the job involves, what the hours are like, what the money is like, I know that. And in the banking field, so it worked out quite well for me. But today, if someone came up to me and asked me, Swami Nahansa, I'm 15 years old. When I'm 25, what should I be? Do you think I'm going to tell them a computer engineer? A banker? Would you? Why not? Why not? What's so wrong with that? And you know, 99% of the population of the world, right, would give that answer. What population? 99, sorry, I missed a 0.9. 99.9% of the world's population would give that as an answer. I mean, you know, becoming an engineer is no little thing, is it? In this day and age, right? And it matters not which field, right? Whether it's physics or some other field of science, chemistry or computer mechanics, computers, mechanics, right? It doesn't matter, rocket engineering, whatever. In whatever field, becoming an engineer is a big thing. Because you have to be very educated, you have to be very focused, a lot of skills you pick up along the way, and very well regarded, and it has a very distinguished place in society. When you were, you know, when you had your own children, these were some of the dreams that you had set for them. Just give me a quick show of hands, mothers and fathers in the room. Right. So when you were younger, when your children were younger, so when they were, let's say, 10, 12, that sort of age, just starting out in life, wasn't this one of the dreams that you had for them? Doctors, not a dream you had for them? Yes. Lawyers. What do we have here? Scientists, teachers, professors. These were some of the goals that you wanted your children to have. You know, literally go back down memory lane. You might have even had these conversations with your children. I remember walking up to my dad and asking him, Appachi, what do I, you know, because it was time to choose my O-level subjects. That was the first time it happened. So we could choose. They were the mandatory subjects and they were always the optional subjects. It mattered very little which subject you chose, but it was a big deal for us. Because for once in our lives, we could choose. So scholarship, you can't choose anything. All the way until grade, 9, there was nothing you could choose. But then, you know, come grade 10, you can actually choose. So you're, you know, it seems like you're making, it's like make or break. You know, this is a big deal for us. If you were there, you'd remember. It was a very, very big deal. Sometimes the choice is, am I going to do Oriental music or Western music? Even that was a big deal. Because for once in our lives, we were able to choose something. And it felt like my whole future depends on that. So that was what choosing for all of us was like. So I went up to my father and asked him, what should I do? So he would give one way or the other, because you know they realized this. Although this is a milestone, it is not the defining milestone. They'd say, Putai, it doesn't matter what you choose right now. 2 years' time from now, you will have a bigger choice to make, right? Just prepare yourself for that. But you know that I wasn't happy with that answer. So I had to go to a few more people. Because I wanted to make an informed choice. And that was when we realized that after we'd made that choice, you know, some of the factors that influenced these decisions were, will you be in the same class as your friends? Even they, those were important factors to consider. So of course your parents didn't know those answers. It was only you who knew. So it was not merely what professions or careers you could go into by making these choices, but also who was going to be in class with you. Was your best friend going to be in the same class as you? If you chose music, what would your best friend choose? Right? These were also important factors to consider. So when my father said, you know, it doesn't matter, just choose whatever, don't waste my time. Right? 2 years from now, come back and tell me. Well, if you've passed your O-levels, we'll talk about A-levels. But I wasn't happy with that. So I went around the houses, right, asking the Ayyas at school, what our seniors, like what choices they had made and how they had faced those questions and how those choices, the choices that they had made had now influenced their level of happiness and what they're like and so on. So anyhow, we all made some choices, and then came the bigger milestone. That was the defining milestone, right? What were you going to do for your advanced levels? Now, that was big, wasn't it? Because you knew, after that point, it was a bit like this. So you had your O-levels, now you had all the way from grade 1 to grade 9, right? This is like the main highway, right? So there are no side lanes, you'll all have to go the same way. Then they came to grade 10. At this point, you had to choose. You had a few choices to make, but after that, they all came back to the same level. And then from there, again, you had your A-levels. So that was in grade 12. Now, you are starting to specialize. In fact, all of this came together, and now you had, what streams do we have? Science stream, math stream, commerce, arts. Now, one of these you had to choose, but these paths took you on very different journeys. At least that is what we were told. If you took the science, if you took the art stream, you'd go on to become these professions. If you took the science stream, you could go on to do these things. If you took the math stream, you could do these things. And if you took the commerce stream, you would do these things. It seemed like, at this point, if you don't make the right choice, I don't know if you remember being in that situation. If you don't make the right choice, then everything's going to be just doom and gloom. It was a very defining moment of your life. Although today you realize that none of those choices really mattered at all. See, we all made a choice, whatever that choice was. We all made a choice, but look at yourselves today. None of those choices have mattered. Because today, what you are doing today, here, right now, under this roof, what you are doing today, here, does it matter whether you chose commerce, arts, maths, or science? Does it? What you're doing right now? No, it does not. But when we had to make that choice, it was a big deal. A very big deal. Because we didn't see the end goal of doing any of these things. For us, it was simply a matter of who do we become? Who do we end up calling ourselves? Then even when it came to doctors, now I remember I was in a position where I could choose not just the science stream, but I could choose whether I was doing biology or human biology. You have no idea how many conversations I had with so many people, just which one I was going to choose out of the two of them. It really didn't matter at all. It didn't matter at all. Even to get to university, it didn't matter. What you did for your A-levels, whether you did biology or human biology, didn't matter. But I was always thinking to myself, I want to become a doctor. So to become a doctor, which one's going to be more helpful? Which one's going to be the better choice? Because, you know, becoming a doctor was everything I wanted in life. That for me defined the pinnacle of life. It was what I was living for. Because, you know, when you started off at school, that is what you have to become, right? Yes, you have to go on to do various other things, you know, build a house, buy a car, be a father, and so on. But a very big part of who you are is your profession. And there was a lot of talk among people about who you should go on to become. This ambition that you have apparently was a very big choice to make. It's a very, very important decision in life. I think only second to who you're going to get married to. Only second to that. Your profession? Who you're going to become? Because the status that was also involved. How people are going to regard you. All that was involved. What it's going to bring you in terms of career prospects. All of that was involved. So many things defined where you were going to take your life. So I was determined that I wanted to become a doctor. And I'm sure there were many in the audience who were equally determined about whatever profession you were in. And these choices, it mattered a lot to you. It felt like if you made the wrong choice, that would be a slip-up and you would completely ruin your career. I remember feeling that way. But today I realize, and don't you, today I realize that none of those choices actually mattered at all. It mattered absolutely nothing at all. Because those choices, yes, there were choices that I made at the time and maybe it shaped my direction in life to some extent. It may be what brought me here, but now that I am here, none of those choices matter. But, you know, it's not just students who chose science or art or math, you know, who are here amongst us today. There are those who haven't actually completed their O-level education. Noble hearts. They're only just starting out in life. So it mattered not what choices they had made to these questions in life. They're all here. Because none of these questions, these choices mattered. But when we were making these choices, when these choices presented themselves to us, when we were at these milestones, at these junctions, it felt like, didn't it, that these were the defining choices in life, and if you get the wrong choice, then your whole life would be a disaster. For me, it certainly felt that way. That's why when I ask you today, you know, which one would you recommend? So if someone comes up to you today, they're just having done their O-levels, they come up to you and ask you, Madam, sir, should I be taking the commerce stream, the math stream, the science stream, or the art stream? What are you going to tell them? Which stream? They're here asking you, which stream should I enter? They want to become a stream enterer. What do they want to become? A stream enterer. So they're here asking you, which stream should I enter? What are you going to tell them? See, your answer is very different today. If someone came up and asked me, which stream should I enter? I said, I'll tell them, it matters not which stream you enter, if these are the streams that you're going to choose. But let me show you a different stream to enter. These choices, not so important in life. Because you know, don't you, that no matter which stream you choose, all of these, yes or no? All these streams end there. If all streams end in the great ocean, which stream should you row your boat in? If all streams take you to the same destination, which stream should you row your boat in? So, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. But ultimately you end up dead. What's the point? And then what happens after that? Back to square one. How many times have you been through this cycle now? Have you mastered the right stream? So which choice is the right one? Tell me. You know, your children are going to come up to you and ask you this question. Mother, should I be doing the arts stream? Should I take the science stream? Should I take the math stream? Or should I take the commerce stream? Which one? And in all of us, they'll ask you, which of the optional subjects should I take? Should I take music? Should I take dance? Or should I take art? Which one? Are you going to sit them down and talk to them about? Because they're going to come up to you and ask them, because they feel that these choices are going to be life-defining choices. It's make or break for them. If all streams end here, what does it matter which stream you choose? Now you see, there are two exits to this building, isn't there? No matter which exit you choose, you're going to have to go back round and go past the pond that we have there if you want to head to the Dhamma hall, right? So, if you come and ask me, Swaminanda, which door should I choose? Which one? Why does it matter which one you choose? Because both doors, you have whichever one you take, you're going to have to walk around and take the same route to the Dhamma hall. So, it matters not which route you take. Are these the life-defining choices, I ask you? Are they? But aren't these the choices that seem to be so important in people's lives? See, I really feel for young people of today, ladies and gentlemen, your past is someone's future and someone's present today. Isn't it? Your past is someone's future and someone's present today. So there are those who are at these junctions in their lives, and they, even today, I don't know, have the A-level results come back yet? This year? Last year's exams? Have they been released yet? No? Not yet. Right. So they will be coming out soon enough. And, I mean, there's another one after this. What happens after A-levels? You have? University. Woohoo! Which degree you take? If death is where you're going to end, which degree do you want to take? Which degree do you want to take? I remember making these choices. It felt like if I make the wrong choice, oh my God, life will be so harsh on me. I'll be a disaster. All my dreams will just, you know, be destroyed. I had big dreams, big ambitions. And it was very serious, these choices I had to make. But today I realize none of these choices actually meant anything. The time that I spent trying to investigate these choices, going and speaking to people, when I thought that I wanted to do medicine, I actually went and did 2 years in working in a hospital. Voluntarily. Just to experience what that was like and whether that was meant to be, if that is what I was supposed to be doing, whether I really enjoyed that. For 2 years I worked in a hospital. Another 2 years I worked in a care home, looking after old grannies and granddads, and washing their bottoms and feeding them and washing them and all that. All that because I wanted to become a doctor and I wanted to make sure that that was what I wanted to do. See, I wanted to make the right choice, and that's why I put myself through that. I put myself through 2 years of an internship and another 2 years of actually back-breaking work. It was quite literally back-breaking work. On some days we had about 25 patients you had to attend to. And when we were short-staffed, sometimes two staff members to look after 25, then sometimes there was only one. So we'd start work around 6:30 in the morning. I'd have to get myself to the care home. And then from 6:30, sometimes it goes on till about 10 p.m. And it was very laborious. It didn't help that I was a little bit taller than others, because once when you start washing them, what do you have to do? You got to bend. That's how I picked up a backache. And I still have remnants of it from time to time. But I put myself through that because I wanted to make the right choice. Do I want to become a doctor? Do I really, really, really want to become a doctor? I'm telling you, why oh why did I waste my life? All those years, I'm not talking about doing the work. I earned merits out of it, although I had no real understanding about how those things would give me merits. Right? It was simply a choice that I wanted to make, and I wanted to make sure that I was making the right choice. That was all where my head was, but I'm sure I must have picked up a few merits along the way. I was not there for the merits. Okay, let me be clear about that. But I might have earned a few merits. But I was there because I wanted to make the right choice. Was medicine what I really wanted to do? In the end, I didn't even do medicine. Although I had set my mind at it and I decided, yep, medicine was what I wanted to do. In the end, I went on to do computer engineering. My point is this, folks. All of that was to make sure that I made the right choice. Do you think I was making the right choice and doing the right things to make the right choice back then? I was not. Because that was not the right choice. It was not the choice that I had to make, really. Because I thought the question that I had to come up with an answer was, what is the career, what is the profession that has to be mine? That I thought was the question. In fact, what was my ambition? That is what I thought. Today I realize that is the same reason why you tell me, when someone comes up to you and asks you what ambition should one have, you tell me today you read between the lines and you realize that that is not the actual question they are asking. But today only I realize that the real question that we are all asking is, how do you be happy? None of these paths lead to happiness. None of them. Absolutely none of them. But don't you see how the whole world, the education system that we have, you know, we have a very sophisticated education system nowadays, don't we? You have a plethora of choices that you can make. Those days, we used to have very few choices. Do your O-levels, do your A-levels. It was, you know, one or maybe two or three options we had. I remember when I was younger, we had four back then. But even before that, I think there were only three choices you could make. They didn't have commerce a long time ago. Science, maths, and arts or something, yeah. Now you have these choices, and if you want, now you can completely, you know, step outside this stream, the local A-levels, and you can start doing, what do you call them? London A-levels. And then aim to go to foreign universities, because there are more choices that way. People are very keen to make sure that they have as many options and as many doors open to them so that they can keep making those choices until they get to ultimately that very specific place that they want to be in life. But alas, all the wrong choices. If you drive down, you know, one of these streets in Colombo, and I can't remember their names now. Let's just take in Colpetti. It's been a long time since I went that way, so I can't remember the names, right? If you go down, say Gold Road. If you drive down Gold Road, just take account of how many educational establishments they have scattered around the place. They'll all be places that give our young people choices. Choices to get them to a certain ambition in life. And these establishments, they're not little places. They're big establishments, very well established, many years of experience. They'll have consultants there you can go and speak to. Some will even hire consultants from outside. They'll bring down people from foreign countries, from foreign universities. They have open days where you can actually go and visit them and talk to them and ask them questions about, you know, what we can do, what are our options, what are our choices, how can I get my children to have the best education. Then there are places that they will lend you the money. They'll give you student loans, they'll give you grants and all sorts of things. You can apply for them, and, you know, it's very sophisticated. But what a pity, we are still talking about making the wrong choices. Do you see how it is much ado about nothing? We're talking about doing a lot, but it's about nothing. Nothing meaningful. And I'm talking about one choice here, about education. There are many more choices that will come in life. Like, who are you going to get married to? Another important choice. Yes, they can make life hell for you, or they can make life sort of a heaven for you, but ultimately, both of them lead here. See, whichever partner you get, ultimately you end up here. Whatever education you get, ultimately you end up here. Whatever you choose to dress, ultimately you end up here. So these are all the wrong choices to be making. It's not a choice between which of these A-level streams you have to take. I mean, okay, choose one. But whatever you choose, it matters not. I am an example of that, and as are we all examples of that. Why is it that we all chose different streams and yet we are all back here? We are all back here. We are all now here at the feet of the Lord Buddha, looking for answers from him. Because university didn't have the answers. But how many years did you spend at university? How many years did you spend at university? 3 years minimum? 4, 5, 6? Did they teach you to make the right choices? What did you learn at university? How to be happy? Did they teach you how to be happy at university? I ask you. Ladies, gentlemen, no matter how many years you spent at university, where do you end up again? Here. So, it's not an important choice, is what I have to say. It's a choice, and we have to make some choices. Whatever choice you have to make, you have to make. But it is not the defining choice. It is not the most important choice. But if you ask a lot of people, young people these days, if you ask parents these days, these are the most important choices that they have to make for their children. Wrong. They've completely got it messed up. These are not the right choices to be making. It's a pity, don't you think, that we as human beings, we have such intelligence. We have so much intelligence about us. But we spend a lot of time making choices that mean hardly anything at all. It's like when you're procrastinating, right? Say you have an important assignment, a task to do. Say you have some homework to do. One of the best ways to try and avoid doing that is to try and choose which pen to use. Do I use the blue pen? The red pen? The black pen? Which one? You can spend your time trying to pick the right pen to do the task. Does the task get done that way? No, it doesn't, because that is not an important choice. But often we spend time making those choices. Like another example might be, you have to do your homework. Where are you going to do it? Are you going to do it in your living room? Are you going to do it in your bedroom? Are you going to do it in the sitting room? Are you going to do it in the TV room? Like, people spend a lot of time trying to find where to do the homework. How many marks do you get for that? None? None at all. But these are perfect techniques for procrastination. People do that because they don't like to do the homework. Those who like to do the homework, it doesn't matter to them what pen, just pick whichever one you can find. Wherever you are, open the book and start working. But when we procrastinate things, when we don't like to make the important choices, we just spend our times making trivial choices. Life is a summation of all that. Unfortunately, it has come to that. Right from when you started to when you end, the total sum, the net result of all of the choices you have made is as if you made no choice at all. Just put aside the Dhamma that you have learned, put aside the journey that you have made on the Noble Path, and give me a nod whether you agree with me on this or not. The net result of all of the choices you have made. So we're ignoring the Dhamma, we're ignoring the Noble Path, we're ignoring your practice towards Nibbana. The net choices you have made, okay, ultimately has zero effect on your life because you're back where you started. Yes, you earn some merits along the way. Some of the choices might have been, am I going to do a meritorious deed or an unmeritorious deed? Those choices, yes, they mattered. But merits and demerits, you've done plenty of them in your life. In your life in samsara. That's all we knew to do. Good deeds and bad deeds. Good deeds and bad deeds was what brought you here. What brought you into this human world? Good deeds and bad deeds. Kala sukhang and kala sukha vipakang. That is what has brought you here. And this is what's going to get you from here to another place. And then from there to another place. And then from there to another place. So this jumping from one place to another is the best you can do with merits and demerits. So these, all of these choices, the net result of all of this is absolutely nothing. Nothing meaningful. But now you're beginning to make some important choices, meaningful choices. And those meaningful choices start the moment you choose the Buddha Sasana. When did you learn, and in which course did you learn, that when you have a problem, when you have a vexation, what you should do about it? When you are disappointed about something, when you are angry about something, which course teaches you what to do when you are angry about something? Not anger management courses. They don't teach you what to do when you're angry. They teach you how to manage your anger. They don't teach you how to rid yourself of anger. They don't teach you that. There are no courses that you can take. How much can you pay for an anger eradication course? How much is it? An anger eradication course? Which university offers them? Oxford? Massachusetts? MIT? Do they offer anger eradication courses? They don't. Can you go to Harvard and get a degree in anger eradication? You might become an anger management specialist. That you can get at Harvard. I'm sure you can. But how can you get an anger eradication specialist? How can you become one of those? Because they don't have the answers. I'm trying to help you figure out one of two things really. One, how fortunate you are. How fortunate you are, how fortunate we all are, now that we are actually making the important choices in our lives. All these years, folks, we've spent so much time fiddling with the trivial choices that have been presented to us that actually meant nothing. It mattered not which choice you made at each of those junctions. Because, see, we are all here again, back where we started. So none of those choices actually meant anything. So how fortunate we are to be able to do that. And secondly, to have a think about where 99.9% of the world's population today spend their time wasting their time. Because the net result of all that is a big fat zero. What a pity. So let's never find ourselves trying to go through these trivial choices that we have to make in life, you know, just to get to the next stage, because that is not the important choice to make. The important choice to make is, when you're angry, what do you do about it? When you're vexing, what do you do about it? When you're disappointed, what do you do about it? These are the important choices to make. You get onto a bus. You get onto a train. You have reserved a seat. You can reserve seats on trains nowadays, can't you? Yes. Buses? Intercities? Yes, you can reserve a seat. You have reserved a seat, you get onto the vehicle, and your seat is taken. Someone has come and taken your seat. They've taken the liberty to keep your seat warm for you. So you walk up to them. And the moment they see you walking up to them, their eyes shut, and they pretend that they're asleep. You know that this is just pretending. That they were fine, they were fully awake as you walked onto the bus, got onto the bus, and now they saw you approaching it and checking your ticket and the seat number. They saw you doing that, and now they're asleep, pretending to be asleep. What is your reaction in this moment? How do you begin? How do you process this? Don't you feel angry? Don't you feel like they're doing something they shouldn't be doing? That is, yes, they are doing something they shouldn't be doing. That's fair enough, right? But what is your emotional reaction to that? You feel anger. You feel annoyed. And now you feel like you have to approach them and talk to them. All of that is fine. Approaching them, talking to them, you know, reminding them, excuse me, sir, this is the seat that I've booked. Would you mind? All of that is not the problem, but you, even before you approach them, you are beginning to feel anger within you. There's resentment. You're annoyed, and that's you have already failed. already failed. Because, you know, you're going to get a seat, but who's going to be sitting there? Someone who has failed. You're already angry. So they've already taken your happiness away from you. If happiness is all we want to be, they've already taken your happiness from you. So how do you deal with such a situation? Which course teaches you how to be like that? How to address these problems? If you become which one of these, do you not feel anger in such situations? See, the answer to this only lies in anicca, dukkha and anatta. So do you know how to apply anicca in such a situation? How do you tackle these problems when they come to you? These are the practical problems, right? You woke up and someone's taken your seat. Now, I'm not talking about walking up to them, confronting them, but confronting them politely. Like, there are two ways in which you can do that. You can confront, you can talk to them. Sir, this is the seat I have reserved. I think it is. Do you mind if I take my seat? That's one way. You can also say the same words, but inside you're burning. There's, you know, being polite is simply an external facade, right? What's going on inside, who knows about that? You know what's going on inside. Externally, you can be polite and very courteous to people, but inside, if you're burning, you've already lost. These are the places where you shouldn't lose in life, because these losses, they're very expensive losses. Because when you get angry, you have failed the purpose you came into this world in that moment. That chitta will never be happy again. Yes or no? That chitta will never be happy again. Because it's never going to come back again. See, you let a chitta go by, and that chitta is never going to be happy again. Because, you know, there is no you to be happy or sad, right? Think about this for a second. Who are you? Mister? No, you know that's not what I'm asking. Who are you? You are just a chitta. So if you're just a chitta, in this moment, you are the chitta that is in you right now, right? So if you are really concerned about happiness, okay? If you are really concerned about nibbana, which chitta's nibbana should you be concerned about? Which one? This one, exactly. Let's focus on that. I'm trying to get across a really, really interesting and really important point to you. When we often think about Nibbana, we are thinking about the Nibbana that comes in the future. Then you think about, I am going to attain Nibbana. There is no I to attain Nibbana, so that sort of Nibbana never comes. If you are thinking about attaining Nibbana tomorrow, it is not Nibbana that you are trying to attain. Let's get that straight. Nibbana doesn't come by post. It doesn't come tomorrow. Nibbana is Nibbana here, right now, because all you have is the chitta that you have right now. So you can't aspire to a Nibbana tomorrow. You either are in Nibbana or not in Nibbana. These are the two choices you can make. Because the next chitta you're trying to get to Nibbana, it's not here yet. So there is nothing for you to do for that chitta. Try and understand this, try and make sense of this as best as you can. This is where we are right now. We are on a chitta. Okay? Are there ever two chittas at the same time? Never. So, when we talk about the present, pachupanna moment, right? This is all we have. At any point, when we take a snapshot of who you are, if this is the body, then this is the chitta. This is all you are. At any point, this is all you are. Let's let this chitta pass, and now we are at another chitta. And at that moment, who are you? That chitta. Yeah? No other. There's no, not a future chitta, not a past chitta. There's always only a chitta. So if this is the only chitta you can do anything about, and Nibbana is your purpose, whose Nibbana can you actually have an impact on? Whose Nibbana can you have an effect on? Only this chitta's, right? It's only this chitta's Nibbana can you be concerned about or do anything about. There is nothing you can do. This is the present. This is the past. This is the future. Can you do anything about this chitta snibbana? Let's go back to the past. The chitta that arose before this one, can you do anything about that chitta snibbana? You can't. How about this chitta snibbana? Now think about individual chittas, because that's all there is. Can you do anything about this chitta snibbana? You can't. Why not? Why not? It hasn't come yet. It hasn't arrived yet. So if it hasn't arrived yet, how can you... Can you throw a birthday party for a child that hasn't been born yet? You can't. This child, this chitta hasn't been born yet. So there is nothing you can do for this chitta's nibbana. This child is dead. So there is nothing you can do for this chitta's nibbana. So this chitta which you have in the present moment is the only chitta whose nibbana you can do anything about. So if you tell me that happiness is the sole purpose of your life, yeah, and you mean that, you're genuine about that, you're authentic about that, you really mean that happiness is the only thing that you're concerned about, then whose happiness can you be concerned about? Just this one. Can you make this one happy? Can you make this one happy? You can't. This one is dead and this one hasn't been born yet. So this is the only one whose happiness you can actually do anything about. This hasn't come yet. So if happiness is the purpose that you want, when I say happiness in life, life is only what you have right now. When I say, do you want to be happy in life, I don't mean about this chitta and I don't mean about this chitta either. Because those things, how do you know whether this is ever going to come to you or not? What guarantee do you have that this chitta will ever arise in you? You have no guarantee. So then you can't, it's unfair to consider this to be part of your life. And this has already gone, so there's of course nothing you can do about that. So the only chitta you can influence, you can impact, is this present chitta. Now, you step into the bus, you have booked your seat, it's reserved, but you walk down the aisle and you see that someone sat there. Which chitta is experiencing anger? This one, this one, or this one? This one. So, are you okay for me to erase all this, the rest of it, because there's nothing we can do about them? Yeah? So, I'm going to take this one out, because there's nothing we can do about it. I'm also going to take this one out, because there's nothing we can do about it. Let's focus on the only thing we can do something about. Now you're angry. In this moment of anger, if you have truly sought refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, see, seeking refuge implies that when you have a problem, you don't look for answers outside that. That is what seeking refuge actually means. Now, you see, in some countries, they give you they accept refugees when there are wars going on, civil wars and so on, right? Or even disasters, natural disasters, they accept refugees. When a country accepts a refugee, a nation accepts a refugee from another nation, they accept that from here on, henceforth, this individual will be completely reliant on the infrastructure, on the services, and whatever our nation can offer him. So when you come in as a refugee to whichever country you go to, what you're saying is, when you apply as a refugee, there is my home country where I'm originally from. They cannot sustain me and I'm not happy there, or there are some threats there, and so therefore from here on I'm entirely reliant, entirely dependent on the generosity, on the charity of the country into which you're going into. The same concept applies when you take refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. So you can't claim to have taken refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha if, when you have such problems, such as anger, you resort to means other than the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha to address them, to find solutions. Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha are all to be found within. The Buddha arises in this chitta. The Dhamma is applied to the chitta. The Sangha is what the chitta does with the Dhamma. I'm showing you how Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha relate to an individual chitta. We've not talked about this before. We so normally think of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. You think, right, I have committed my life to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. We think about in individual terms, don't we? We as individuals have taken refuge. This morning you observed the precepts. Before you observed the precepts, what did you do? You took refuge. Buddhan saranam gacchami and so on. So you feel like you are, you know, you have taken refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha and you are holy. You feel that way. What I'm trying to relate to and show you is, individual chittas are all there are. There are no individuals. No future chittas, no past chittas. This is just the present chitta that we have that we can deal with. So therefore, the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha must have some way to apply to an individual chitta. Otherwise, it doesn't apply to anything. Don't you agree? If the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha cannot apply to an individual chitta, what does it apply to? Me or you? Who? It can't apply to any of these people like you and me because there are no such people, right? All there are chittas. So therefore, Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha must apply to an individual chitta. Buddha is what this chitta should aim for. Buddha is the state, the natural state of this chitta. Until it is defiled by kleshas or defilements. Buddha is that natural state. So if it is born with defilements, then Buddha is the target. Buddha is the goal. Buddha is the ambition. Dhamma is the teaching, the instruction that is required to achieve that state. And Sangha is what the chitta does, the practice of that Dhamma to achieve that status. All within an individual chitta. That is how Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ, Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, to an individual chitta. Now, let's go back to that situation. You booked your seat, but there's someone there that annoys you. Who's angry? Chitta is angry, exactly. The chitta is angry. Not I am angry, or I will be angry, I was angry. This is just grammar. But in real terms, there is no such thing. There's just anger in the present chitta. This chitta is angry because it hasn't sought refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. That's all. So now, we are trying to learn how an individual chitta can take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. Because once you have taken refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, there is no room for anger. Anger goes away. Because what is Buddha after all? Can Buddha exist with anger? Have you seen or heard of the angry Buddhas? You have heard of laughing Buddhas. But there are no such things called angry Buddhas. Because those two are not compatible. Buddha is a natural state of the mind. A mind that is free of defilements. So, anger and Buddha are mutually exclusive. So, the only reason then that anger has taken over is because there is no Buddha in the chitta right now. What helps the chitta become Buddha is the Dhamma. That is the teaching. But you can't do it with just the Dhamma, you have to do Sangha. What do you mean by do Sangha? Practice. So you need to know what to do and then you have to do it to get to Buddha. Now we've learned about anicca. Let's think about how we can apply the anicca is the Dhamma. Anicca is the Dhamma. What is Buddha in this context? Asking them to get up and leave. Is that Buddha? Having a go at them? Is that Buddha? No. What is Buddha in this context? This is Buddha. If you can get your chitta to a state where there is no longer anger by applying the Dhamma. I mean, someone can come and hit you on the head and then you are unconscious. That is not Buddha. Then also you don't have anger. in that chitta. Right? That is not what I mean. If they get up and offer you the seat, then again you are no longer angry. Is that Buddha though? That is not Buddha. Because the Dhamma hasn't done anything yet. This person has helped you to relieve yourself of that vexation, but the Dhamma hasn't done anything yet. If you have achieved this level of happiness and the Dhamma was not involved, don't be fooled to think that that was Buddha. There's only one path that can get you to Buddhahood, and that is the Dhamma. Without the Dhamma and the Sangha, if you have achieved a level of happiness, some kind of happiness, be assured that that is not Buddha happiness. That is some other kind of happiness. Meaning it is very temporary and it's conditional. There's always something that can take it away from you. For you to ever have an unconditional, unshakable happiness, it must have been done by the Dhamma. If you want, you can repeat after me, just so you never forget it. For there to be a happiness that is unconditional, it must have been done by the Dhamma. If anything else gives you a level of happiness, and even if you feel that, no, this is unconditional happiness, and if it wasn't the Dhamma that did it, no, that cannot be so. It cannot be so. So never be fooled. If you want to know whether a level of happiness you have achieved is unconditional, ask yourself one question. What? Was it the Dhamma that did it for me? If you say, no, it was my mother who did it for me. Is that unconditional happiness? Cannot be. My wife did it for me. Can it be unconditional happiness? No. She made me a nice cup of hot chocolate. And I'm very happy as I sip my hot chocolate. Is that unconditional happiness? Cannot be. Why so? Because it wasn't the Dhamma that did it. So any unconditional happiness can only be attributed to Dhamma. Right. So the Dhamma is anicca. Sangha is what you're going to be doing next. Okay? So we know what Buddha is. Freeing this chitta from anger. You know what Dhamma is? Anicca. You know, anicca dukkha anatta, right? You're all that, but let's just focus on anicca for the time being. What is Sangha? That's what you're going to do now. So let's talk about Sangha. Here's what you're supposed to do. So this person is sat here. You are stood next to them. Now you're angry. Who's angry? Chitta is angry. Why do I keep repeating that point and emphasizing that point? That is Dhamma. That's why. I keep bringing you back to your senses because that is the Dhamma that you need to think about. The moment you think that this person is sitting there, he's probably doing it out of spite, to spite me, to anger, to annoy me. He's probably doing that to annoy me. You know, whenever you keep thinking along those lines, you have not sought refuge in the Dhamma. The Dhamma is not going to help you there. See, try and get this point into your heads, ladies and gentlemen. This is a very, very, very practical situation, and the application of the Dhamma, in other words, your Sangha, who's your Sangha? Sounds like a name, your Sangha. Your practice is practice is a practical thing, of course it is. It is something you have to do then and there. What I'm trying to talk through to you is how you apply this anicca in that situation. The situation is you're angry because someone's taken your seat. I mean, it might even happen here. Like, let's say, you know, you find maybe you sit down in the same spot every week, right? You become used to that. Right? You come in one Saturday and then someone else has taken your seat. This could happen to you. And if that happens to you, now, no matter how many times you've observed the precepts, no matter how many times you've said Buddhan Sannan Dhamman Sannan Sangha Sannan Gacchami, you have not sought refuge in the Dhamma, Buddha Dhamman Sangha, yet. Not forever, yet. So it's time to actually start seeking refuge. So bringing your hands together and chanting Buddhan Sannan Gacchami is merely a chant. It's just a chant. It's just to keep you happy, that's all. To make you think that you have sought refuge in the Noble Triple Gem is just a custom that we do. You know, can you not do Buddhan Sannam Gacchami and then go and stab someone? Or steal something? Huh? Or, you know, go adultery? How does that be someone who has observed sought refuge in the Noble Triple Gem? The moment you are angry, you are no longer in refuge. In that chitta, you are no longer in refuge. Whenever the Buddha resides, now Buddha, I don't mean the Buddha, Buddharajanan Mahansi, I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about a state of mind, a mind where there is no anger. If that is the state of mind that you're in, that chitta has achieved Buddhahood. Now, how do we apply Dhamma, the Dhamma, to solve this problem? So, go back to the situation. This guy sat on your seat. You're stood there next to them. You see this. Immediately, you feel anger. Now, you need to free yourself from this problem. First and foremost, you need to realize that the problem is within you. For every instance, for every moment that you think the problem is out there, you will not seek, you will not find refuge in the Buddha. The Buddha cannot help you, the Dhamma cannot help you. See, if you think the problem is with the guy sitting here, who can help you? Who can? The guy can. This guy can. He can help you. He can stand up and leave. Or take, you know, jump to the next seat. Is that so, seeking refuge in the Dhamma? So therefore, is that unconditional happiness that you have just discovered? No. Why is that? For it to be unconditional happiness, what must have solved the problem? Dhamma must have solved the problem. Not this guy. So in these moments, if you as a devout practitioner, as a sravaka, as a sravika, as an uvasi, as an anagarika, or a swaminuhanse, if in these situations your immediate response is, yo, that's my seat, man. You're not giving yourself an opportunity to actually practice the Dhamma. It's a lost opportunity. I'm slowing time down here to help you understand this situation, because you know I can only give you this situation now so that when it actually happens to you, you can then, this is the practice arena. When you're out there, when you're fighting with your demons, right? I won't be there. So in those moments, the first thing you need to do is not to ask them to get up and leave. Because you know, the moment you ask them to get up and leave, it's not the Dhamma that's helping you. Because you're never going to have both the Dhamma and, let's call him Tom. Tom and the Dhamma are both not going to help you at the same time. You have to choose one or the other. If Tom's going to help you, the Dhamma's not going to help you. If the Dhamma's going to help you, you don't need Tom to step in. Or in this case, step out. You don't need. So, in such a situation, try and stop yourself. Try and stop yourself. Hold this instinct, you know, your gut instinct, to try and ask Tom to stand up and leave. Do it only after you have dealt with anger. Let me say that again. There are actually two problems here. I don't know whether you can spot it. First problem, Tom has taken your seat. Second problem, absolute. Well done. There are two problems here that we have to solve. The funny thing is though, if Tom gets up and leaves, what happens to the anger? That also leaves. You know, it's like, say you have a pet dog, and you haven't washed the dog in, say, 3 weeks. Like, now the dog stinks. Okay? It hasn't bathed. Fleas, and the dog stinks. Now the dog is walking around, he's sat down under your seat, okay, under your chair. Now it smells, doesn't it? It stinks. There are two problems though. In fact, two things going on. One, there's a dog under the chair. Two, there's a smell. If the dog leaves, what happens? The smell goes as well. But does it actually solve the problem of the smell? Does it? No, because what can happen next? You chase the dog away, and what can the dog do again? Come back again. And this time it's going to come back even smellier, because it's going to come again 2 days later. So now it's going to be 3 days, 3 weeks and 2 days of not having washed. So it's going to come back stinkier, smellier than when it left. So try and stop the urge, your instinctive feelings to ask Tom to get up and leave. Because if you do that, like the dog walks away with the smell, when he comes back again, the smell is still going to be there. As I say, there are two problems here. You have to be intelligent enough to spot the two problems and distinguish them separately. This you apply this situation in as many places as you can over the course of the next week. I'm giving you one example, but you can substitute your problems into this. Your children haven't done their homework. You get home and the dishes have not been washed. You ask someone to run an errand for you, go and pay some bills, whatever, and they haven't done that. You ask someone to switch off the tank, and now the water's overflowing, right? And they haven't done that. So when you get back home, you realize that the water's been running and you have wasted so much water. See, these are moments in which you might feel anger. But the most important thing to do here is first distinguish the two problems as separate problems. The motor has not been switched off. Yes, that is one problem. Anicca dukkha anatta cannot help solve that problem, can it? If you walk in front of your motor and go, Anicca, do you think it's going to switch itself off? No, you need a timer for that, so that next time it doesn't happen. Or an auto switch, right? So it picks up when the tank is full. That problem, science and engineering will solve. You need science. These are the practical problems. But this problem is an internal problem. One problem exists outside, the other problem exists inside. What is the outside problem here? Let's say you reserve that seat because you have some knee pains and so on. So you need the seat, don't you? Otherwise, physically, it's very uncomfortable. And the doctor has said, don't keep standing for long periods of time. So whenever you're traveling, make sure you have a seat for you. So therefore, you have reserved your seat. Should you not here on reserve seats for yourself? Because every time some Tom, Dick, or Harry goes and sits in your seat? No, you must reserve your seat. And now that you are, after you have dealt with your anger, should you not ask Tom for your seat? What do you think? Shouldn't you? You should. You should. Don't kick him out. That's bad. Because you won't kick if you're not angry. Don't kick him out. You can ask him to leave. And what if he doesn't leave? You ask him to leave. Now, let's say we've dealt with anger. Okay, but he's still in the seat, right? Because that's the external problem. Now he doesn't leave. What can you do next? You have to make your mind up. Is it? No. You can go and speak to the conductor. What's wrong with that? You speak to the conductor. And if the conductor says, sorry, can't do anything about that, speak to the driver. But not when you're angry. What can the conductor do when you're angry? Nothing. Unless he preaches the Dhamma. What can the driver do about your anger? Nothing. He said, let me give you a refund, sir. Let me give you a refund. Sorry about the inconvenience we have caused you. Let me give you a refund. Have they addressed your anger? No. They've only addressed the external problem. Don't be fooled to think that the external problem and the internal problem are one. It'll seem like that. This is also because of jati. Jati is such a demon, right? It'll make you think that this internal problem, external problem, they're all one. Because this one thinking is all based in jati. That's why you think these flowers are pretty. When in reality, prettiness is an internal thing. The flowers is an external thing, right? This arrangement is an external thing. But the beauty that you see when you see this, that's an internal thing. But don't you feel that the beauty is in the flower? That's jati. In the same way, when you're in this situation, if Tom gets up and leaves now, your anger will also leave with it, making you think that it was Tom that made you angry. That's jati. Because, you know, jati has a trick that it does, it plays to stop you from eradicating jati. I'll say that again. Jati is so cunning. It's a mastermind. It's a mastermind invention, this jati business. It is so cunning that it is designed in a way to stop you from thinking of a way to eradicate jati. That is why you need the perfect one to come and distinguish that this jati is the reason why anger happens when this happens, and the two things are unrelated. That is what the Buddha does, ladies and gentlemen. See, he disconnects this external problem from the internal problem. Have you ever felt that anger was not because of this gentleman sitting in your seat before you had the Dhamma? We've always felt like they're there, and that's what makes me angry, right? We've always felt that way. Have we ever addressed them and said, you know, sir, please could you stand up? Because if you keep doing that, I'm going to get really angry. Have you not told people, don't make me angry? Why do you make me angry? Have you not asked people that? I mean, what a nonsensical question to be asking. Why do you make me angry? Why do you always make me angry? Why do you always annoy me? How can anyone annoy you? But that is jati doing that. I'll tell you why. Jati's days are numbered the moment you realize that these two things are distinguishable. The moment you realize that anger is a product of jati, and this external situation is merely an arrangement of energy, matter, whatever you want to call it. It's just an external affair, this is an internal affair. The moment you realize this, now jati's days are numbered. Because who wants to be angry? Anyone here who wishes to be angry? Do you enjoy being angry? Isn't that why you, when you think that it is Tom that makes you angry, you go up to Tom and say, Tom, get up and leave, man. This is my seat. Don't make me angry. Don't you say that? Don't you tell your children, Buddha, why do you always make me angry? Why do you always make Ami angry? Why can't you do your work when I ask you to do it? Why can't you make your bed? Why can't you clean your room? Don't you ask these questions? Because you don't enjoy being angry. That's why whenever you feel anger, you address it. Don't you? When you feel anger, don't you address it? You do. What does that prove to you? You don't enjoy being angry. So now then, once you identify that it is anger and this external situation are two different things, which one do you go to address now? Do you understand my question? Do you enjoy being angry? Do you? No one enjoys being angry. So when you are angry, what do you do about it? You do something about it, right? Something to help you come out of anger. When you thought that Tom being in your seat is what caused you to be angry, what did you do? You woke up to Tom and you asked him to leave without making you angry. Because you don't like being angry, that's why. One day, you listen to the Dhamma and you realize that this is an external thing. Anger is an internal thing. Now that you've realized that, I ask you the question again. Do you enjoy being angry? Do you? No. So what are you going to do now? You're going to address anger. So now you have realized, though, that it is not this that caused anger. Anger is a different matter, and that's caused by jati. The moment you realize that, now what are you going to do? You're going to address that. And now you're going to address jati. So do you think jati wants you to identify that? Separate them and distinguish them. Jati would never want you to identify that these two things are separate things. Because if you do, Jati's days are numbered. Therefore, what Jati does is it bundles this together and makes you feel that it is because Tom's in your seat that you are angry. So therefore, here's what you do all the time. Tom, give me my seat. And here's what else happens. When Tom gets up and he leaves, you feel that anger's gone away. All the time, your bad knowledge, this ignorance, keeps being reinforced. That is also a trick of Jati. Remember, Jati is self, or this perception of self. And when there is a perception of self, there is also a mechanism to preserve it. After all, self-preservation, without self-preservation, there wouldn't be, none of this would exist. The whole universe exists as it does because of self-preservation. And self, ultimately, is preservation. These two things are synonymous. Self is preservation, preservation is self. That's what we call self-ish. What does self-ish mean? Preservation, right? When you are selfish, you preserve. You're always protecting yourself. That is what self-ish means. So self and preservation, they're synonymous. So self by its very nature will have internal mechanisms to stop you from identifying that it is the culprit of these problems. It's all inbuilt. This is a perfect system, an almost perfect system, only to be beaten by the perfect one. You can't find a way out of this. If ever, if there was just a glitch in your system, like just a glitch in your system, and Tom's in your seat, you're feeling angry as you look at him, and like say, just for 2 seconds, you don't feel anger. For 2 seconds, you don't feel anger. And then you're angry again. If something like that ever did happen, now you begin to wonder, whoa, hold on. Tom was there in the seat and for 2 seconds I didn't feel anger. So the two things may not be related. But it's never like that. Whenever you are annoyed with this, or whenever you don't like this, anger will always be there as part and parcel of this situation. Thereby denying you the opportunity to distinguish these two things separately. Right, now that you've understood that, let's get back to Sangha. We are here to do Sangha now. So the first thing I ask you to do is, don't fall into the trap of asking Tom to get up and leave. And here's why. If Tom gets up and leaves now, you will stop feeling angry. And if you stop feeling angry, you might be fooled yet again that Tom's presence is what made you angry. Now, this advice I only give to people who are serious with their practice. Okay? If you are really not serious with your practice, just ask Tom to get up and leave. Otherwise, it's going to get worse. If you are really not serious about your practice, right? If you're just a fashion Buddhist, Buddhist for fashion, right? Just because it's the trend these days. Everyone has to come to the monastery, everyone has to listen to the Dhamma, everyone has to pretend that they're all practicing. Right? If any of you are like that, just ask poor Tom to get up and leave. Otherwise, you don't know what might happen here. But if you're serious about your practice, if you're honestly serious about your practice, don't ask Tom to get up and leave. Unless, of course, if you don't sit right now, your whole body is going to collapse and you're going to die or something terrible is going to happen. In such a situation, which is almost never, right, you can ask Tom to get up and leave even while you are still angry. But if not, let Tom be there for a second. Because you have a bigger fish to fry. You're still angry. Let's not give ourselves another opportunity to fall into the trap of thinking that it was Tom that caused me to be angry. Let's not give ourselves another opportunity to think that. So while Tom is still there, in your mind, you need to now start distinguishing these two things. So these words you must remember in that moment. How will you remember? By practice. What if you haven't practiced yet? That's the catch-22. Until you practice, you won't remember. And until you remember, you won't practice. So which one do you do first? Can you get the fire? And the more the fire there is, the bigger the fire there is, you start putting wood at it. Because without the wood, you're not going to get the fire. And if there's no fire, why would you put wood into it? This is how, you know, the average person thinks. The average person always thinks, if there's no fire, why do I put wood? Why do I put wood into it? But someone who goes outside the average way of thinking thinks, well, let me put the wood first. I'm talking about a fool. A fool always asks the fire, why should I give you wood if you're not going to give me fire? If you don't give me heat, why do I give you wood? A fool asks this question. Who wins this? Does the fire or the man who asks this question win? The fire always wins. In other words, the fire dies. Right? But who loses in the end? The man who wants the heat, he loses out. So you must always put the wood first and expect heat later. That's how it works. So even in these situations where, you know, it might be you're still only starting out in your practice. So therefore, it takes a while for the Dhamma for you to recall the Dhamma. But do it while it's still difficult. Even when it's difficult, even when you haven't mastered it, still do it. Do it to the extent that you can do it. How do you learn to ride a bike? After you can ride the bike, you learn to ride the bike? No. You first get on the bike and sure as hell, what's going to happen? You're going to fall. Once you fall, what do you do? You tell yourself, I can't ride the bike. The day I can ride the bike, I'll get back on the bike. No one does that, right? You have to get on the bike even when you know you're going to fall. So in the same way, even when you know that you still haven't mastered this art, you still have to try. Today you will try with just 1%. 1% luck. 1% of your practice will work, but this will not always be 1%. If you do your 1% today, that will become 2% tomorrow. If you do your 2% today, it will become 4% the following day. This is exponential growth. It will. That is how it works. It's not just a straight line. The better your practice, the better your practice will improve. So it accelerates. It does. Honestly, it does. The better you're at something, the quicker you can improve. So there's an exponential growth with your practice. So have confidence and have faith in that. Now, so in this moment, these words must come to your memory. That's why we have a pirit thread. Right? As you put your arm out to tell Tom off, you see, Guru Andhra gave me a pirit thread. Retire. This is to remind you to separate the problem. Tom's in his seat. I'm angry. These two are unrelated. You have to start there. I can't see a better place to start this. You have to start there. These two things are unrelated. When these two things are unrelated, now tell me, I'm assuming now you are on the same, we are both on the same train of thought here, okay? So now we have two problems. Tom's in your seat and you're angry. Which one do you actually feel is the more painful of these two? Number one or number two? Number one, absolutely. Number one is the more painful. It is what hurts more. That's why you have jati paccha, jaramanna, shoka, parideva, dukkha. There's an element of physical pain which jati amplifies. That's why Rahatan Mahanse can bear a lot more pain than we all can. Physical pain. Even if a Rahatan Mahanse gets a backache, a knee ache, body aches, headaches even, they can bear that pain much more graciously than you and I can. Because they, as they have no jati, that pain is not amplified in their mind. They just perceive pain as pain. They don't feel that it is I who hurt. So, you know, if there are any among you, and then I know some myself, if there are any among you who, maybe your parents, right, maybe your grandparents, who are really struggling with physical pain and discomfort, and it's just agonizing, right? They've tried every trick in the book. They've gone to the best doctors, they've tried traditional medicine, they've tried Western medicine, right? They've tried everything, and still, the pain remains with them. One of the best pieces of medicine you can give them is the Dhamma. That will reduce their pain by at least 75%. Honestly. And then if you can develop your samadhi even further, right, by mere resolve, you can make that pain completely go away. But even when you are not in a state of samadhi, just when you are, you know, you are conscious about the pain, you know that the pain is there, you can then perceive the pain, but just the pain. Not the pain that comes with the pain. Not the agony of the pain. So these are all treasures of the Buddha Sasana. In every hospital, they must be preaching the Dhamma. I tell you. There should be a separate clinic where patients, pain management, right, they are sent for Dhamma sermons. Swami nurses can go and help deliver the Dhamma to people. If they can start working on jati, right, the physical pain will remain, but the mental pain that comes with the physical pain, which makes the pain unbearable, intolerable, that starts to go away. Which of these two is the more painful? Number one is the more painful. So which of these two are you going to address first then? Number one. Unless, like I said, right, if you don't sit now, your legs are going to break or you're going to faint or whatever. In such situations, just ask them to stand up. We can work on the anger later. But in every other situation, first of all, separate these two problems and now start working on this. Once you have addressed this, you can address this. Don't worry. I'm not saying let's completely forget about this. No, we have to get our seat. But first of all, we have to deal with anger. Because this opportunity may not come back again. It will in other guises. But this particular opportunity, let's just remember, Nibbana is in a chitta. There's no point in you telling me, no point in you telling or convincing yourself, well, for today I'm going to get the seat. Tomorrow, which chitta is that? That one. When this chitta comes, I will address the problem. That is not Nibbana you're doing then. Nibbana, if you're doing Nibbana, your compassion has to be extended to this chitta in which the Dhamma lives in the present moment. Your future Nibbana, compassion towards the future chitta means you are not compassionate towards the present chitta. How can you show compassion to someone else which you don't have towards yourself? It doesn't work like that, right? So who is yourself in this situation? This one. This is yourself. You can't show compassion to a future chitta if you don't have compassion on the present one. That's why you have to love yourself before you can love another. This is another. This is another. This is not you. This is another chitta. Remember we had a talk about don't be self-conscious but be chitta-conscious? It's that concept again that we're talking about here. Now we are angry. So I can take all of the rest of it out of the board and just deal with anger. So this is the problem we're trying to deal with. And we need the Buddha, which is, so this is the situation, state we want to try and get to. We have the Dhamma. And now we are going to apply the Dhamma. Okay? Right. Step one. Separate the two. That is step one. Which we've done now. We've talked about that. Anger is not caused by Tom being in my seat. Everyone okay with that? Anger is not caused by Tom being in my seat. Which is why you're not going to ask Tom to get up and leave. If it was, you'd have to ask him to give, but it's not. So you're not going to do that now. Second, We need to understand what anger is. Let's understand what anger is. You go through these emotions, these emotional rides, roller coasters, when you don't understand what those emotions really are. That's how you ride these emotions. You know, you're taken for a ride, after all. Only because you don't understand what's going on. In this moment, remind yourself of the dependent origination process. Not the whole thing. In fact, not even avidya pachya, sankara pachya, you don't, not any of that. Just this. Jati, pachya, what is pachya? The one who has a tattoo. Is that a pachya? No, cause. Jati is the cause of. Is the cause of is what pachya means. Okay? Jati is the cause of what all mental fires. You call it the 11 great fires. Whether there is 11 or 11,000, it doesn't matter. If at all there is a mental vexation, it is all based in jati. Right? That is, no questions are. That is the truth and nothing but the truth. There is nothing to doubt there, nothing to question there. If you have to question it, then you cannot apply the Dhamma then. Remember, I'm asking you to do what a Sotapanna can do in those situations. So what I'm actually asking you to do in such a situation, you can only do if you are a Sotapanna, honestly. So how do you know whether you are one or you're not? Because you can't be certain of it, just assume that you are and try and do it. If it happens, then it's happened. If it doesn't happen, then you just need to come back and learn the Dhamma again. That's all. As Guru Chandra always tells us, when you're listening to a sermon, assume that you are a Pruthakjana. When you're outside the sermon room, sermon hall, and you're out in the field, right, when you're out there battling, in those moments, assume that you are a Sotapanna and try. And try. Because if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, then you just need to come back and try again. Learn again, try again. So when are you Sotapannas? Outside this room, we're all Sotapannas. Happy now? When you're back here, you're all Pruthakjanas. Not so happy now. That's how I think to myself. So now it doesn't matter to me whether I'm Sotapanna or not. When I'm out there, I just practice what I have learned from my teacher. If it works, then it works. That's all. But if you feel like, you know, I don't know whether I'm Sotapanna or not, so will it work? Will it work? Will it work? You know, for those, will it work? It'll never work. Because you're always doubtful whether it'll work or not. Is the water cold? You know, when you take a shower? You don't take the plunge. You don't jump into the shower. You just like, I don't know, is it cold? Put a finger in it. Is it cold? Right? While you're thinking that, you're hesitating. You don't jump. But if you jump into the water, right, after a while, it's okay, isn't it? So the same thing, same concept applies here. Right. So here's what you need to remember in that moment. Jati is the cause of it. What is the cause of it? Jati. Jati is the cause of anger. Now, the moment you think that jati is the cause of anger, haven't you given anger a cause? You've attributed anger to a cause. If something is conditioned, in other words, if something arises due to causes, what does that tell you about that thing? If you don't want it, you can eradicate it. If you want it, you can keep producing it. Isn't that so? Yes. It is only possible, these two things are only possible if something is conditioned. If something is not conditioned, you don't have these options. You know a fire is conditioned. Therefore, if you want to keep the fire lit, what do? You keep adding those causes. If you don't want the fire, what do? You take out one of the causes. Now that you know that anger is caused by jati, if you love your anger, if you just want to keep being angry, what should you do? Just keep feeding jati. That's what you do when you watch a movie. Think about it. When you're watching TV and you're enjoying your movie, right? When you're enjoying a comedy or action or romance or whatever, you know, horror. Because you enjoy horror, people watch horror movies because they enjoy that feeling of, you know, that fear, right? So you can't experience fear unless you feed jati. Remember, anger, fear, lust, none of these feelings, none of these emotions can stand on their own without the support of the causes that keep it there. This can't stand up here until and unless I keep holding it up here. The moment I take my arm away, the moment I stop providing energy, the pain's going to drop. So when you watch a film, if you like romance, for example, right, and you want to watch a romantic film, while you're watching the film, don't contemplate on jati. If you like romance, don't start thinking about avidya, pachyas and all that stuff. Because if you start, what's going to happen? You're not going to be able to enjoy the film. You know I'm being sarcastic, right? So if you're watching an action film and you like the action, like 007, there's the villain who's running after the hero's running after the villain, and it's getting very intense. Right? In that moment, don't think about avidya, paccaya, sankhara. You're going to spoil it for yourself. I mean, you paid, what, 2,000, 3,000 rupees to go to the cinema to watch the film? When you're there, stop thinking about jati. Don't remember a guru hamdro, right? Don't remember the dhamma. Don't think about any of these things, right? Don't ruin it for yourself. Don't spoil it. Experience fear, anger, lust. Right? Because the moment you start contemplating jati, what's going to happen? It's all going to fall away, fall apart. So don't do that. Once again, I'm being sarcastic. Unless if it's not obvious. So jati is the cause of anger. If jati is the cause of anger, now you know that if you don't like anger, did we not agree earlier we didn't like anger? Remember, there were two discomforts, and you told me, in fact, that anger was the bigger one. That is why, while you don't have a seat, yes, but you want to deal with anger first, right? Jati is the cause of anger. So now, if you need to deal with anger, what should you deal with? Jati. Is there anything else you need to do about anger? What do you think? Must you handle, sort out anger, or should you just work on jati? Just work on jati. Just work on jati. Is anyone in this room in any doubt about what I just explained there? If you are, let me know so I'll explain it to you further. Is anyone in this room in any doubt about this? What? It is jati that causes anger. And if you don't like to be angry, all you have to do is deal with jati. Eradicate jati and anger will be gone for good without you even touching anger. Anyone here in doubt of any of that? All clear to everyone. Perfect. So now, what is the problem now from here on? It's not anger, is it? What's the problem now? Jati. So in fact, we can take this out of the board, I said. So now we've taken Tom out of the board. Remember where we started? When we started, we had Tom, who was being a pain. And then we removed him from the board because he was not the problem. Then we had anger. Now you're telling me, no, Swami, no, anger is also not the problem. Now what's the problem? Jati. What we did with anger, now we are going to do with jati. What did we do with anger? Exactly. Because we didn't like anger, what we did was we went to investigate what the causes were that gave rise to anger. And then we decided we were going to deal with the causes, not the result. We went along and found out that jati was a problem. So we apply the same principle to jati. We go looking for the causes of jati. Because what can we do once we identify that? Leave jati alone. Nothing to do with jati. In fact, there's nothing you can do about jati. Because jati is caused by causes. It's the causes that you need to deal with, never the result. This is the Buddha's instruction. This is the Buddha's philosophy. Always deal with causes. Ye dhamma hetu pabhava. Tesang hetu tathagatavaha. Tesang cheva nirodho evangvadi mahasamana. Ye dhamma hetu pabhava. It is hetu, the causes that give rise to whatever. Dhamma can be anything. Right? Dhamma is not just Buddha Dhamma. Dhamma can be anything. Jati is also a Dhamma. What about anger? That's also a Dhamma. Fear, lust, desire, greed, jealousy. All of these are Dhamma. There's Buddha Dhamma and then there's Mara Dhamma. These are all Dhamma. Wholesome Dhamma and unwholesome Dhamma. These are all Dhamma. So, ye Dhamma hetu pabhava. Te sanchiyo nirodho. If you identify the causes and eradicate the causes, you no longer need to worry about the result or the product. So that's exactly what we're going to do with jati. Now, let's get to the cause of jati. What is jati? What causes jati? Exactly. Jati is your perception that there are entities in this world. That is what jati is. This sense of a self, the sense of a uniqueness, the sense of an identity, the sense of an entity, these are the things that we refer to as jati. So when you have the sense of a self, you have the sense of an identity, you have the sense of an entity, an individual, a person per se, now there is jati, in other words, separation. You know, every time we talk about this self, business, what I need you to reflect on, ladies and gentlemen, is actually we are talking about a separation. The reason that you feel that you are an individual is because you feel you are a separate individual to the person next to you. Isn't it? We are all individuals. What do we mean by an individual? We are separate to the person next to us. And it's because we feel like that internally, we look at the whole world in that way. That's why these two things also seem very separate entities to us. It's the same way in which we look at ourselves, we look at the external world. All these things seem to be separate, external, be it external or internal, we perceive them as separate entities. Because separation is what's going on here. So jati is another... Jati is an expression of separation. It's one expression of separation. So that is jati then. Jati happens, you know, because of ignorance and attachment. You know this. Now you'll start remembering the things we've learned in the Dhamma school, in the Dhamma class, in the sermon. You'll remember that there are vipakas that happen. The karmic strand that gives rise to a vipaka, right? This is, in very simple terms, you have a vipaka. So these vipakas can be sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, and even thoughts. So thoughts that you have, these are all vipaka. This is a natural process. And at each moment, one of these come to fruition, they mature, and they pass away. So this is the arising and passing away. This is a cycle that causes no suffering at all. There's no suffering anywhere to be found here. But we have jati going on here. So what does jati do? Jati ignores this, all of this. Jati ignores the fact that all of this are one, all of this is of the same source, all of this is the same energy. And it wishes to. So jati is a product of ignorance, as you know. Right? What is ignorance after all? Ignorance is the thinking that there are separate entities in this world. Now, remember, I'm asking you to do something practical here. So you need to be able to do this in that situation. If you can't do it in that situation, then this this instruction is, it has not really done much for you. Remember, you know, you're on the bus. Imagine yourself, you're on the bus. There's Tom seated there. You've told yourself, Tom sitting there is not the problem. Anger is the problem. Now you started dealing with anger. Then you reminded yourself that jati is the cause of anger, so therefore jati is the problem, I don't need to worry about anger. Now you're dealing with jati. And now you know that jati is caused by a need for separation. You wish to separate yourself. You wish to identify things as separate. This is the separation and the need for separation. So, you only need to separate it. Separating is possible, right? If separation wasn't possible, or if at least you didn't feel that separation was possible, why would you try and do that? Yeah? If you didn't think that it was... You see, if you didn't know that you can take the cap off, would you try? Why don't you try and do this? Why don't you try to do that? You don't even consider. Why not? Because you don't know. Maybe it is possible. Maybe it's possible. But you don't know. There's no reason for you to think that taking this off, what off? You think there's nothing here to be taken off. So therefore, you don't try. But if I held the pen to you this way, now you try. You try it because you think it's possible. Yes? So therefore, you try to separate because you think what is possible. Separation is possible. So you have this idea that separation is possible. But you don't do things just because something's possible. You do something because you like to do it. You enjoy doing it. It's pleasurable. Once again, we don't do things just because it's possible to do. I mean, can't you chew on this? The dog does, but you don't, right? Why don't you do it? Is it not possible? It's possible. You can chew on this, but it's possible. But you don't do it because you don't want to. You don't think that it's a nice thing to do. You're not going to enjoy it. So therefore, you don't do it. But even if you did enjoy it, and if it was not possible, would you do it? No, you want to do something, but it's not possible. Would you do it? It's possible, but you don't want to do it. Would you do it? No. So, if I drew a table, there are two things that have to work. You have to want to do something, and it has to be possible. You don't want to do something, but it's possible. Would you do this? This one you would do, wouldn't you? You want to do it and it's possible. You want to, but it's not possible. Would you try? No. You don't want to, and it's not possible. Would you try? No. You want to, but it's not possible. Would you try? No. So there's only one combination that you would actually try. That is, you want it and you think it's possible. I mean, this is always thinking possible. Doesn't have to be possible. You think it's possible. Right? So, then the same concept applies to jati as well, separation as well. You think separation is possible, and not only that, you want to separate. Why? Because you believe that separation is pleasurable. Separation gives you satisfaction. Separation gives you joy. It gives you pleasure. Then you'll ask me the question, so why do we think like that, Swami? Why do we think that separation gives us pleasure? Why do we think that separation gives us joy? Why? Well, how do you rationalize ignorance? How do you rationalize ignorance? You can rationalize wisdom. You can rationalize the truth. But how do you rationalize a lie? Yeah, because there is pleasure. From your experience, you have had pleasure in the past. How was there pleasure? Because initially you thought it was possible, and you tried to do it because there was a promise of pleasure. There was a promise of pleasure initially. So you can't say there was pleasure initially. There was a promise of pleasure. The promise of pleasure and the promise of a possibility was there. These two things, when they were present, you tried to do it. What happened to the mind when you attempted? It went into vexation. Yeah, because you try to do something and it's not possible. Remember, it's not possible. You think it's possible. Thinking it's possible and being possible are different things. Yeah, so you think it's possible. It's like if you're, you know, if you try to touch the roof. When we were younger, we would try and jump and touch certain things to see how high you could reach. Sometimes, you know, there were certain heights that were beyond our reach, but we kept trying because we thought it was possible. I remember I tried to drive my father's car when I was only 10, because I thought it was possible. My mother gave me a earful that day. That was the last time I tried. But I thought it was possible. So when you think something's possible, you try it. It doesn't have to be. You try it. I give you a pot that has a hole. You don't know about this hole. What do? You try to fill it with water. Is it possible? Is filling this pot possible? No. But what do you think is possible? What do you think? You think it's possible. So you try it. So to try something, it doesn't need to be possible. You just need to think it possible. Same way, when you think that separation is possible and you like the separated thing, you like the separated thing, you like the entity that you are trying to separate here, when these two factors come together, now the chitta, this chitta, we are still on that chitta, the first chitta we talked about. This chitta now begins the separation process. But first of all, you know, really, the chitta doesn't begin the separation process. What the chitta does is it now waits to experience that separation. You know, the chitta doesn't go into separation mode right at the beginning. Because it thinks it's there. Because it thinks it's there, it awaits it. Otherwise, why would it get to vexation? Now, the chitta doesn't know that I have to do abhisankara and separate this. That you only get to know after you have wisdom. We are talking about a chitta that is ignorant. You think the chitta knows that it is out of abhisankara I get my separation? Do you think the chitta knows this? If it did, what does it think about separation? What would it think about separation? It would know that separation is not possible, right? So the chitta does not know that separation comes out of abhisankara. It doesn't know this. I mean, that is why we call it an ignorant chitta. So the chitta thinks separation comes from this vipaka process. So as the vipaka happens, the chitta now wishes to experience this separation. And it waits. And it waits. And it waits. But there is no separation to be had. So now what does it do? Now it goes into vexation, because it's looking to experience separation. Do you remember another point to help you really get this point into your heads? We talked about this some weeks ago, not some weeks, maybe even months ago. How are we doing for time? We still have some time. Do you remember? I asked you this question, and now you'll see how it all relates to this. Why the chitta goes into this separation? I ask you this question. How do you get someone to experience happiness by simply presenting to them a single object? Now get those cogs turning in your head. I gave an actual situation to you as well. I told you something like this. I said, say there's a mother at home, she's trying to get some work done. And there's a little kid who's always bothering the mother, he or she doesn't let the mother get their work done. So, now the mother has to find a way to entertain this child, to keep them engaged. And the mother just has a single object. So for the child to be entertained, now the mother has to come up with something creative. But there's only one object to do this. What do you think the mother can do? Hide it. That's what the mother can do. Hide it and ask the child to find it. Because this is one sure shot way of achieving self-gratification. if ever you want to find your thrill, right? You want to find a joy from a single object, one of the best ways of doing that is hide it, but no point in you hiding it. Ask someone to hide it and then you go looking for it. What happens? What happened when you lost something and you found it? It gave you pleasure, right? Could an object on its own give you pleasure ever? A pair of keys, a bunch of keys, can it give you pleasure? Your glasses, can it give you pleasure? Can it? A book, a pencil, a pen, a watch, can these things give you pleasure? No, but if you lose them and then you go looking for them and eventually you find it, what happens to you? You feel pleasure, right? See how innocent little objects can give you so much pleasure. All you have to do is lose it and then go find it. This is how individual objects, little innocent, you know, objects that mean nothing, can still give you happiness. The same thing's going on here. For you to experience pleasure, you have to be able to compare two things. Because it's only in comparison can you find happiness. So when you lose something and find it, that is also a comparison going on. Because in your mind, you have this upadana rupa of the object that you desire. You have an object that you desire and then you find the object from the outside. And when the two of these match, that's when the fireworks happen inside. That's where joy comes from. So even when we talk about individual chittas, if the chitta is informed, rightly or wrongly, that separation is possible, that a sense of identity is possible, a uniqueness is possible. Now, for the chitta to experience joy, all the chitta needs to do is to go and find it from somewhere, like any lost thing. I don't know how successful I am at trying to get this point across to you, but let's keep trying. I'm trying to teach you how to make happiness out of nothing. Where there is no happiness, how do you find happiness? This is not Nibbana. Okay, this is anything but Nibbana. I'm trying to teach you how you can be happy with something as simple as a duster. For happiness to exist, there must always be a comparison. This I'm talking about conditional happiness. This is the condition. What is the condition? I want something, I have found it. When these two things overlap, now we call it happiness, or rather pleasure. When these two things don't overlap, now we call it displeasure. While you are looking for it, we call it vexation. Make sense? While you're looking for it, you're vexed. When you find it, you are in pleasure. When you don't find it, you're in displeasure, disappointment. You see, for existence to happen, we need to somehow, let's say you and I, it was our task to design this world from scratch. Okay, now I'm trying to give you a chance to be God. It's our chance now to design existence. Let's just say nothing exists right now, just you and I. Okay, we exist in this room and we are sitting around the discussion table trying to figure out how can we create existence. Can you imagine what I'm asking you to do? You and I, we exist. Nobody else in this world exists. Not even an atom exists in this world. Nothing exists. It's just you and I. So we are trying to think, come up with a plan on how do we create the first chitta. Okay, so we are all in the Maha Brahmaloka. We are trying to create the human world and all the beings in it and all the chittas and all that. Now, we are discussing a few options. How do we do this? Here's what I propose to you. Let's create a chitta. A chitta is ultimately nothing more than the perception process of a vipaka. Yes, the perception process of a vipaka is called a chitta. Aramana, vijanana, lakkhana. That is a chitta. The perception process of a vipaka. Let's create that. But That alone does not work, because once the vipaka runs out, once all the vipakas have been exhausted, now you don't have the world again. Because, you know, once a battery runs out, now you have to put a new battery in. But we need to create a self-sustaining method here. How do we create a system where when the batteries are discharged, there's another process that recharges the battery? Because if we can do that, once you create it, we can go and work on something else. That system will keep running. A self-running, a self-sustaining system. So what's the task we have to do now? Create a self-sustaining system. We have at our disposal some energy. We can use that to create this, but there's no point in just putting that energy there, because what's going to happen after a short while? That energy is going to run out, it's going to deplete, and then at that point the system is going to fail. So we need to find a way to put the energy, this energy cell, this bank of energy there, and then introduce a system that keeps recycling that and recharging that system. So here's my proposal. Here's the source of energy. Here's your energy, which you and I, we refer to as vipaka. Here's the system. I propose, and you tell me whether you like it or dislike this. If you don't like it, we can try and work on something else. Let's create a process. We call it a chitta. What this chitta does, is it takes some energy from this system and it perceives it. Okay? It perceives it. But once perceived, this energy is lost. So what happens after a while? If you start at 100%, if you keep going, after a while, it's going to run out. That's no good. We have to have a system that keeps recharging this battery. So here's my proposal. Let's create a chitta that takes, so a chitta is essentially taking a part of this energy from this. Okay? And we have to get this chitta to do something to create energy and put it back into this system. To do that, this has to go through a process. So jati is the process of putting that energy back into the system. That is what jati does. Rahatan vahanses have no jati. They are just a vipaka process. So with a rahatan vahanse, if you just continue to keep a rahatan vahanse alive, at some point they are going to consume all of the energy that they had built out throughout samsara, throughout by doing karma, and that energy is going to run out. And at one point, even without aging, a rahatan vahanse is just going to drop. And energy, all matter, energy is just going to disperse back into space. By space, I don't mean that space, I mean pure energy. Okay? But to keep this cycle going on its own, we need to give it a task. And here's the task. Go looking for something that doesn't exist. But why would they do that? If I ask you to go looking for an elegraph, would you go looking for one? I say, can you go to the zoo and find me an elegraph? You'll ask me, you mean elephant, Swaminas? No. You mean giraffe, Swaminas? No. Which one do you want, son? Elegraph. Would you get up and leave? Would you? No. Because you think such an animal does not exist. But if I can somehow convince you that such an animal does exist, does it really? No. That such an animal does exist, now I can get you to leave the room to go and find one for me. What are you going to look for? An elegraph. When you leave this room to go looking for one, you will keep looking for it. You'll go from zoo to zoo, from zoo to zoo. You'll go to a zoo you have in locally, then you go to another country and go looking from zoo to zoo. at some point, because now you want to find this elegraph, and there's nowhere to be found in any zoo out there, you're going to start vexing. So now we are designing, okay? We are creating the blueprint for a self-sustaining system. Because there's no point creating a system whereby you can actually find what I'm looking, what something that really exists. If that were the case, you couldn't have a self-sustaining system. Once again, if the task was, go and find something that really does exist, you won't have a self-sustaining system, because that is what a Rahat Hanuman says. They only look for things that do exist. So what happens? The battery runs flat. But a Seka individual or a Pratakjana individual, so those who are not Arahat Anuhanses and those who are Pratakjanas, the task that we have been given is to find something that does not exist. That is an elegraph. If I ask you to find an elephant, you can go and find one in here. If I ask you to find a giraffe, you'll go and find one in here. But if I ask you to find an elegraph, they don't exist. So if they don't exist, but I have convinced you that they do, what will you do now? Keep looking for it. You search far and wide, you just keep on looking for it. And here's what else I have also told you. Elegraphs are the most beautiful things there are. They're so beautiful. If you see one, it'll give you a sense of joy that you have never experienced before. I have to give you that as well. Not just go looking for an elegraph, but I have to tell you that the sight of an elegraph, it gives you so much happiness, you can't even imagine. You've never experienced that sort of joy. So now you go on looking for an elegraph. You keep looking time and time again, time and time again. You keep from going zoo to zoo, still looking for an elegraph, but you don't find one. But here's what happens. In our system, we have to create a mechanism that gets you to think that you have found one. You have to be able to hallucinate. You have to be able to do that. So you have to be able to have illusions. That ability also we have to include into this process. So that we have to build as a feature. So what this box does is it creates illusions. This box, it creates illusions. Now, some energy has been released, the chitta has been born, and we have included the ability for this chitta to create illusions. You're looking for an elegraph. You think it's going to give you tremendous joy, an infinite amount of joy, and we have a system in place to create an illusion for you. So at some point, when the chitta has tried its level best, and nothing seems to work, at some point it's going to come and hit this illusion box. In other words, where the chitta goes into its deep states of vexation. Because you're going to vex. Would you ever vex if you were tasked to find something that actually does exist? Would you vex? If you were tasked to find something that actually does exist, would you vex? Would you? You wouldn't vex. If the task was to go and find something, if I asked you to go and get an elephant, you can get an elephant. A giraffe, you can get one. But an elegraph, you can't get that. So you will only vex. But you have this illusion system in place. What that illusion box does is, it creates an illusion of an elegraph based on what you think it is. And now, you think you have found what you were looking for. And here's what happens in this moment. Remember that joy that I promised you, that happiness that I promised you, the point I said about this elegraph being the most beautiful thing in the world, and once you see it, your heart is going to be full of joy. Well, that happens to you now, because the illusion has been created. So the moment you have this illusion now what happens is, you were looking for an elegraph. So you had in your mind an image of what an elegraph was like, because you had to know how to find one. If you saw one, you had to be able to identify one. You had an image of what it was like, because I created that picture in your mind. And then you never found it, but the illusion of one you came across. Now these two things, they overlap.
Is that insane?
This is insanity mode, yes. This illusion box is when you get into insanity mode. Yes? So at this point, you had what an heliograph looks like. Say the heliograph looks something like this has a trunk. Okay, that's what an heliograph looks like. This is the mental image that you have in your mind. The illusion box, it creates something very similar to that. Now these two things, they overlap. Because they overlap, like when you go looking for something you have lost and you find it. Yeah? In the same way, when these two things overlap, you feel a sense of sheer joy. And that joy was what you were looking for. And that joy reinforces this process. It tells you this is a very successful method of achieving satisfaction, achieving pleasure, and being joyful. Now it is self-convinced. I no longer need to convince you to go and look for happiness, because you are now convinced by yourself that this process works. So therefore, what do you do now? At the point of you creating this illusion, this packet of energy that was taken from this cell, at the point of creating this illusion, it generates an amount of energy. It generates an amount of energy. Part of it goes out into free space, but part of it goes back into the system. This is where we say a karma is done. This is only possible at the point this illusion is created. This is what we call bhava. Bhava and the jati that happens beyond that. When bhava and jati happen, it actually creates some energy that can now be replaced for the energy that was used from this system. So therefore, this system never runs out. So as you're consuming it, it is being charged. You know, like the batteries that you have in modern cars these days. You run it with the battery and then you charge the battery once you switch to fuel. This is when you're running on fuel. But the fuel is also part of what the mind does itself. But it recharges the battery. You see, this is all possible because an heliograph doesn't exist in reality. If there was such a thing as an heliograph, this process would not work. That's why it doesn't work with Arahatan Vahanse. Because Arahatan Vahanse only expects a rupa, not a rupa atta. He doesn't expect a separate rupa. He only expects rupa. If he expects rupa, is there going to be a problem with that? What comes out of this? Rupa. He expects vedana. Is there a problem with expecting a vedana? No, because what comes out of this? Vedana. He expects sanya. He expects a sankhara. He expects vijnana. There's nothing wrong with that, because rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara and vijnana, they all come out of this energy. So, therefore, Arahatan Vahanse does not have this insanity process, this illusion box. So, therefore, there is no energy that is being generated to put back into this process. So, whatever energy comes out, that energy passes away. That's why I say Arahatan Vahanse will soon enough deplete this energy, and then the battery runs out. And at some point, Arahatan Vahanse would not be able to exist, because they simply consume energy that was already produced previously. Now, we are trying to deal with anger. We've spoken about all this to explain to you how this separation process works. Because we were going from question to question, as to I asked you, now we have anger. Anger is based in jati. And then when we try to figure out what are the causes of jati, and then we said it was separation. And then I helped you ask the question back from me. So why are we interested in separation? The reason we are interested in separation is because of ignorance. And we can't rationalize ignorance. How can you rationalize a lie? You know, you think you're female, right? Why? How do you rationalize that? You can't tell me, Swaminasa, because look at me. Am I not female? Look at my long hair. Look at my chest. Look at the rest of my body. Don't I look like a female? No. That's just matter arranged in a certain way. Why do you think you're female? It's the question I'm asking you. You can't tell me it's because of the way I look. No, that's the body. I'm asking you, the mind, why do you think you are female? How do you rationalize that? Give me an answer if you can. How do you rationalize the fact that you are female? How do you rationalize the fact that you are male? Gentlemen, why do you think you are male? That's like asking, why do you like the color red? Why? What's so special about red that you don't have in green? What's so special about green that you don't have in blue? These are just colors. How come you have a favorite color? Remember, Guru Andhra used to ask this question a lot. Why do you have a favorite color and what's the rationale behind it? In the same way, if you think you are a man, you think you are a woman, what's the rationale behind it? You can't tell me, look at my physical form, I am a woman. No, that's the body. I'm asking you, the mind, why do you think you are male? Not the body. Why do you think you are male? Who's you here? The mind. What is the answer? There's no answer because it is ignorance. Ignorance has no rationale. Someone's afraid of going into the dark. You ask him why? Because it's dark. How is that an answer? If you're scared of the dark, someone asks you, why are you scared of the dark? I don't know, I'm just scared of the dark. Why? Because I'm scared of the dark. Why? Because I don't know what would happen. Right? Maybe there's something there that's hiding in the dark that might attack me. Then you switch on the light and show, no, there's nothing there. Right, now switch the light off. Right, now go into the dark. No. You've convinced them that there is nothing there. But they're still afraid of the dark. Why? You can't explain a phobia. There's no rationale. It's a mental disease. Isn't it? So, you can't rationalize a mental disease. A mental illness cannot be rationalized. The rationale is ignorance. Ignorance has no basis. It is not based in fact. If something's based in fact, you can give factual answers. But if something's not based in fact, how do you give a factual answer? So ignorance cannot be rationalized. Therefore, you remember we had the table earlier. This table, there were four of these. I put some ticks and boxes, remember? And so on. Right? You want it, you think it's possible. You want it, but you don't think it's possible. You don't want it, but you think it's possible. You don't want it, and you don't think it's possible. There's only one combination here in which the chitta will begin to work or begin to want to experience a separation, and that is when you want it and you think it possible. Now you're asking me the question, Swaminanda, why does the chitta think that it wants it? The answer was what I was trying to give you. The chitta thinks it wants it because there's a wrong view, that is avidya. A wrong view has been instilled into the chitta, placed into the chitta so masterfully, to think that pleasure can be found by experiencing separation. It's like saying, here, does this give you happiness? No. Now I go hide it somewhere, and I say the first one to find it will be happy. Yes, of course, the first one to find it will be happy. So now you go looking for it. And then you find it. And you say, hey, I found it. Now you're happy. You're happy because you found a pen. You won't be happy by seeing a pen. You're happy because you found a pen. What's the difference? I see a pen, I found a pen. What's the difference between the two? In both these cases, aren't you actually seeing the pen? But there's something special with finding a pen. That is, you wanted it, it wasn't there, then you found it, and now you're relieved from vexation. That is all an internal mental process, nothing to do with the pen. Nothing to do with the pen. It's all an internal process. So that's how you make someone happy, by showing them a pen. Just show it to them, they're not happy. Hide it, now they're happy, when they find it. I mean, that's how the world tricks you. To make you think, to make you happy, one of the ways to make you happy is to make things unaffordably expensive. Never fallen for that? Make something unaffordably expensive. Now what do you do? You work hard to try and afford it. And then you acquire it. Now what are you? Happy. Give it for free. Are you happy now? No. You see, the same object. It's all about presentation. You give someone something, they're not happy with it. You make it impossible for them to achieve it. Almost impossible for them to achieve it. Now they're happy once they get it. So where does happiness come from then? Relief from vexation. You need to get them to vex in some way. So you and I, we are playing God now to try and create a world in which this can be a self-sustaining system. Ladies and gentlemen, I propose to you, we have to introduce a way for the mind to vex and relieve itself from vexation. Otherwise, it won't be a self-sustaining system. But there is nothing here that actually gives pleasure. There's nothing here that can do that. So the only way then we can do that is plant an ignorance, a view in a chitta. Plant a view in the chitta that pleasure exists somewhere. Now what's the chitta going to do? It's going to go looking for that pleasure. And in its pursuit for pleasure, it's going to try and do whatever it is it can do. Rupas will come, Vedanas will come, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnanas will come. But the chitta wants pleasure. And the chitta knows that to have pleasure, two things must overlap. Yeah? We talked about this a while ago. Two things must overlap. There has to be a comparison. Without a comparison, how do you know whether something is good or bad? Is this good? You might say yes right now, but what are you comparing it with? Yep. So you have something inside. Is it bad? Same thing. So good or bad, you're comparing it with what's inside. Yeah? Just like saying, are these good? Now you think you're comparing the two with each other. When I ask you which one of these two is good, do you think you're comparing them with each other? No. Here's what you're doing. First of all, you're looking at this. And you're comparing with the image you have inside. Then you're looking at this. Then you're comparing it with the image you have inside. Now you're comparing the two results. Yeah? So when you looked at this, let's say the image that you have inside, this is a 50% match. You look at this, it's a 70% match. Which one gave you the greater joy? This one, right? Now you tell me that this is better than this. That's how you like this better than this when these two things are presented. You never compare the two pens actually. You are comparing whatever is out here with your internal image. That's where the upadana comes in. There is no ground, no basis, no fact, no foundations for these two things to be compared with each other. Always the comparison goes on with your internal image of what you think is right, what you think is good. So when we have to design this world out there that is self-sustaining, we have to put into the mind this drushti that there is pleasure out there. And for there to be pleasure out there, the mind now has to have something to go and compare with. Do you understand what I'm saying? The mind has to have something to compare with. Without a comparison, there can't be pleasure. Does this look good to you? Do you like this? When you answer this question, whether it is a yes or a no, what are you comparing this with? What you have in your mind? Do you like this one? Once again, you're doing the same thing. Which of these two you like better? Again, you're doing the same thing. You're not comparing these two things. You're comparing this first, this next, and then comparing the two of them together. In fact, I can now put these two away and ask you which one's the better one. Why? Because it's not these two pens you're comparing. You're comparing your mental impressions together. Based on that, you tell me the blue pen is better or the black pen is better. You can only do this because that comparison can happen only when you can separate two things. These two are separate just as much as this is separate to the image that you have in your mind. Two separate things are now being compared. So in the same way, to experience pleasure, you have to be able to separate something in your mind. Finally, back to Tom. Because we have to end this on that note. Otherwise, we haven't solved the problem. Back to Tom. In your mind, you have already separated yourself. Why did you separate yourself? Because separation is good. Remember, you want it and it's possible. Not it's possible. You think it's possible. You want it and you think it's possible. Now, you have a sense of a self. So, that is now separate. Then, this separation that has now happened within you goes on to separate the whole world. Not just the material things, but also the said things. Words, emotions, actions, these are all separate. These are also separate. You know, this is separate to Tom standing. Tom sitting is separate to Tom standing. Tom sitting on your seat is separate to Tom sitting on someone else's seat. What I'm trying to explain to you is very subtle. I don't know how many of you are actually grasping what I'm trying to get across to you. If this doesn't make sense, we'll go over it again. Maybe listen to this talk one more time. It might help. Otherwise, we'll go over it again next week if we get on the same wavelength. This is a separate, entirely separate thing to this. And this is an entirely separate thing to this. You need these separations, or at least you have to perceive these separations so that you can compare within yourself. So this is you. In your mind, you are separate from Tom, and now these things that Tom does, they're also separate. And then when two things are separate, now you can have a view about which separation is the better separation. Just like you tell me which pen is the better pen. For the better one to happen, you need to have something, some comparison to go on. Without a comparison, there can't be pleasure. And because you have a separation, now you have an idea of what pleasure looks like. So therefore, when you look at this, this doesn't bring you pleasure. Because here's what you have as an upadana in your mind. Who should be sitting on that seat? Who? You. Because it's your seat. Yeah? You or someone related to you. You are happy with your son sitting there, it's fine. You're happy with your mother sitting, your wife sitting there, it's fine. But now Tom is sitting there. Yes? Because, see, those two sittings are different, aren't they? Tom sitting there and your son sitting there are two very different sittings, aren't they? Why? Separation. So you didn't stop at separating yourself as an entity. You've created Tom. You've created Tom sitting as a separate entity, and the vacant chair is a separate entity to the occupied chair. These are all separate entities. Remember, when we talk about separation, we're not just talking about objects here, ladies and gentlemen. All kind of rupa, all kind of vedana, all kind of sanya, sankar, this is a sankar. A sitting is a sankar. You have separated this sankar. This sitting is a different sitting to Tom standing. Someone else sitting on this seat to Tom sitting on this seat is a different kind of sitting. So how many sittings are there? How many kinds of sittings are there? There are an infinite number of sittings. But in this moment, there is one kind of sitting that you like to have. And that sitting is not working out right now. Because right now, you have your upadana, you're clinging on to a certain kind of sitting, but the sitting that you see right now is not good. Now, answer this question for me. You walk up here. Tom stands up and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I hope I haven't transgressed here. This is your seat. I'm so sorry. Please take your seat." How do you react to that? Do you feel angry now? No. Now you feel really happy and you love Tom now. You're like, "Wow, what a gentleman." Where did that come from? Those are even more sankharas which you have separated, and there are the ones that you like, the ones that you're attached to. Can you think about the total number of attachments that you might have? Can you even estimate how many attachments might I have? Do you like thank you better or thank you? Which one do you like better? Thank you. Which one do you like better? See? Even two words, the way they are uttered, you have a preference. So the number of attachments that you have are infinite. Therefore, you can't work on individual ones. You'll never be done. You just need to understand, Anicca is the nature of all things. If you can eradicate your attachment to one thing, you have eradicated your attachment to everything. That's the way it works. That's why, and I'll end on this note, your attachment in your mind is what creates separation. Your sense of identity is your first and foremost separation. This is your primary separation. What is that? Your identity. You haven't given it a name yet, by the way. The name comes later. You perceiving that you are a male or a woman or a female, you are an adult, you are a child, all of these things come later. Your race, your religion, your creed, all of these things come later. I'm talking about individual chitta. The individual chitta identifies itself as a unique entity. This is the first and most primal separation. But the moment that happens, the whole world appears to be separate. Because separation, the moment separation happens, it's like putting on colored glasses. That's one of the best analogies I can give you. When you put on colored glasses, are there only certain things that look that color, or does everything look that color? Everything looks that color. So in the same way, once separation happens within, you experience you are separated, but at the same time, you see the whole world as being separate. So therefore, if one is separate, the entire universe is separate. So your eye, it's like a zero or a one. This is one, this is all or none. That's it. You don't have 50% of the world separate, the other 50 not separate. It doesn't work like that. It's either all or none. If you experience separation, you and everything in this world is separate. If you don't experience separation, you and nothing in this world is separate. We are all one. So now, when Tom is there, you have focused on jati. You have understood now that jati is the reason that you have this anger. And the reason you don't like it, you don't like it because there is one that you do like. What is the one that you do like? This chair being vacant. That's what you do like because it's, you have reserved it. You have to be on that seat. That's what you like. Why is that what you like? Because you have separated that. You have separated that from this. Therefore, you have two things to compare. Because you're comparing, now you have jatipaccaya. And this is piyehi vipayogo. What you like is not being accomplished right now. This is one manifestation of that is anger. Now, when you are there in this moment, what you need to do, folks, from here on, if you have understood what the essence of what today's talk is, what you need to do is get all this into one package. That is what a karmasthana is then from them on. Because, you know, we did this, we've been talking since, what, 7:30. Now it's almost 10:30. You don't have 3 hours to be with Tom. Right? By that time, you'll have to get off and go. Right? You might have 2 seconds before you say something. So what should you do? You need to understand all this so that it all becomes, you know, you distill it down to just one karmasthana. And that karmasthana doesn't need to have a word. But even if it did, let's say anicca. When you hear the word, when you reflect on the word anicca, all of this must come together in one bundle, one package. Like when I say amma. When I say the word mother, doesn't everything about your mother come to you at once? The love you have for her, the love she has for you, her devotion, her commitment, right? All that comes to you at once, right? Her image, how she fed you, how she looked after you, all that comes at once with just one word, amma, that's it. In the same way, that is because you know your mother really well. That's why you've lived with her your whole life, so you know her really, really, really well. In the same way, you have to start living with anicca. Once you start living with anicca, then you'll get to know anicca really, really, really well. And when that happens, you get on the bus, you see Tom sitting in your seat, and you think to yourself, anicca. All of this will come to you in a flash. Not piece by piece, not the words that we have discussed today, not the diagrams, right? None of that. The essence of it. You know, you have the essence of chicken. You use it, mothers, when you cook, right? So it's not the whole chicken, right? the essence of chicken. The same way, you have the essence of anicca when you are in this situation. But for that, you have to distill all of this. And that distillation will come with your practice. So the more you practice, the easier this becomes. So I'll end this on three words. Practice, practice. You say the last one. Thank you. Live with anicca. That's how anicca helps you come out of anger. Next time you see Tom on your seat, don't ask him to get up and leave. Then you're betraying the Buddha, you're betraying Dhamma, and you're betraying Sangha. You're not an Upasaka or an Upasika. You're not an Anagarika or an Anagarika. You're not a Sravaka or a Sravika or an Uvasi. You're not a Bhikkhu. Sabbaso nama rupasmi. Yassanati mamaita. Akatachana sochati. Save bhikkhuti ucchati. Sabbaso nama rupasmi. See, nama rupa. Where you experience a self, you need to be able to come out of that. How do you come out of that? Through your understanding of anicca. Yassa natti mama itam. No mama. No self here. No separations here. Akatachana sochati. Na socha. No conflict here. No grief here. How? Well, when there is no self, there is no comparison. When there is no comparison, how can there be room for disappointments? Because to disappoint, you have to first make an appointment and then diss it. That's how you have a disappointment. To diss something is to miss something. That's how a disappointment works. Fear, grief, all these things happen when there's a comparison. For, to compare, there has to be two separate things. So one who has understood this is a bhikkhu, says the Buddha. So who's an upasaka then? Same. Upasika? Same. Although they didn't have sravaka, sravikas back then in Vaisis, we have them today. That is how you become a sravaka, sravika and an Uvasi. If you are a sila sravika, madam, I tell you, it is only in the chitta that you are a sila sravika. Not in the prema that you have on your shoulder. That doesn't qualify you to become a sila sravika. You are not an upasaka or a sravaka or an Uvasi by having a prayer mat on your shoulder or wearing a utru saluva or coming dressed in white. No. I am not a bhikkhu just because I am in a robe. I am a bhikkhu in a chitta. If the chitta seeks refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, now you are a bhikkhu. No Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, that's not a bhikkhu. That's not a sravika. That's not a sravika. That's not an Uvasi. None. That's lost. That's what that is. Right. Let's conclude then. So let us all take a moment then. To transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swaminarayana to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for everyone to come along and practice, to aspire to their noble aspirations. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits we have acquired to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this message to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take this moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks and sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, And by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employees and our employers, our teachers, our friends and acquaintances, reminding ourselves that in this long journey of samsara, they will all have been part of our lives and done everything in their power to help, support and assist us in any way, shape or form possible. May they all rejoice in these merits. May they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our ancestors, our forefathers, those who passed away in our name. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us transfer these merits to all members of the armed forces and police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, and pandemics, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they'll all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us. They'll have done everything in their power to help us, support and assist us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land, and may you and I, and everyone who has helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Teranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will transfer the blessings to you. Raga ginnen midatnva, desha ginnen midatnva, moha ginnen midatnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, dvesha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivansapa labeva, nivansapa labeva, nivan
සැප ලැබේවා.
තුනුරන්ගේ සූවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයොම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුගතිතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.